One thing before we leave, the t-shirt he's wearing is a guy who didn't have to be, but he was so good to me when I was a rookie professional wrestler. And his name is Bret the Hitman Hart.
Oh, yes.
Comes from a very famous wrestling family. But at that time, he was world champion. And there were a lot of guys in that world at that time in 96 that didn't necessarily embrace me.
Yeah. When you were the good guy?
When I was a rookie coming in.
Yeah.
Because everyone is hungry for their spots. And there's a lot of, as he'll tell you, there's a lot of sharks in the water.
Yeah.
But he was that nice guy, Bret, and he was world champion to show me like how it's done.
Why do you think he was nice to you?
I think because he knew that our families knew each other and knew that I came from a lineage of pro wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that I had a real love and respect for wrestling. And he was just a great guy. And I always like to give him props where I can.
It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! I'm home!
You like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have 2 more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
That was The Rock, who is making the press round for his new Jungle Cruise movie. He and his co-star, Emily Blunt, were being interviewed via Skype or Zoom or whatever it was. And he stopped to acknowledge the shirt that the interviewer was wearing, which was a Bret the Hitman Hart shirt, and to pay respect to Bret for how good he was to him when Rock came into the company as a rookie in 1996. And you know who the sharks were that he was talking about. DX. But Bret was helpful to Rock and to Steve Austin's careers in 96. They've both given him a lot of credit in the past. Rock has always spoken very highly of Bret. But to watch him sit there trying to educate Emily Blunt about the greatness of the Hitman is the kind of wholesome content that I just had to open the show with before I lose my fucking mind here in a second. This is episode number 715 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, August 1st, 2021. I am the Solo Monster. I do want to take a moment here to thank everybody for sending in some nice messages. I posted on Twitter the other day that Friday was the 2-year anniversary that I had my mom's children's book published, The Adventure of Hardy the Horse. It was 2 years ago. And a lot of the sales of the book have come from fans of the podcast. A lot of people have bought the book for nieces and nephews, sons and daughters. It's a children's book. So really, it's good for anybody up to the age of 6. I would say that's kind of the wheelhouse there. And all of the comments and all the pictures people have emailed me and tweeted me over the past couple of years of the kids holding the book, you know, and all, or people reading to them. It's just such a cool thing. And again, I got to give a shout out to Seven Horns Publishing for making this a reality and believing in the story, and to Mark Poulton for the great illustrations, because I hear compliments all the time about the artwork and the illustrations, and it really does bring that story to life. So if anybody is interested and you want to pick up a copy, the book is still available, The Adventure of Hardy the Horse. You can get a copy right now on Amazon.com, and if you do, drop me a note. Drop me a note, let me know, and when you get it, let me know if they like it. I like hearing stories like that. If you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so. TheSoloMonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you to Night Stalker, Naif Al Safar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichert, Ostentatious Alan Carter, John Raging Mad Riffle, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Michael Maximum Payne Palkowski, The Bakersfield Big Shot, Steve Heredia, Killshot Keith Hart, The Alabama Assassin, Chris Young. Philip and his wife run a YouTube channel called My Slotty Obsession, where they post videos of their high-limit slot play from various casinos throughout the country. All of their videos are under 3 minutes. A lot of them are only a minute long. I got a great tweet the other day from somebody who said, thanks for turning me on to their channel. I enjoy watching their videos. Like I said to him, it's actually kind of calming to watch those videos. And you see the little cherries pop up or the lemons or the numbers, whatever game it is that they're playing. There's something calming about those videos. Nothing fancy, just high limit slot play. Type My Slotty Obsession into the search bar on YouTube. Like and subscribe. They post new videos daily. And WrestleRumble.com, last but not least here, is hosting its first custom art contest. They like to mix it up. They offer different types of prizes, not just replica belts. Replica belts are awesome. But they just gave away 2 tickets to All Out in Chicago, which I had the chance to pick the winner on my Dynamite stream a couple of weeks ago. Somebody is going to Chicago and sitting in prime real estate to see All Out on September 5th. This Wednesday, I'm going to be choosing one winner at random to win a custom hand-drawn piece of artwork where Seinfeld meets pro wrestling. That is the theme. This isn't the summer of George. It could be the summer of you. And all it costs is $1 to enter. Now through Wednesday, WrestleRumble.com. This is a one-of-a-kind piece, really, really cool stuff. You can see a picture of it right now and enter at WrestleRumble.com. And then join me live after Dynamite on Wednesday, where I will get to pick the new owner. Now, as I went through all my notes and the rundown of what I wanted to talk about here on the podcast, it's a lot of stuff. It's kind of seemed like maybe a little bit of a quiet week, but it really wasn't. And there's a lot of AEW stuff to get into, but it also ties into WWE, including one crazy story that I would say you won't believe, but you probably would. But I was putting everything together, and then, as is sometimes the case, the day before I do the podcast, I had a bomb dropped on me. And that bomb was dropped on me by WWE. Because on Saturday, WWE announced that it had come to terms on the release of Bray Wyatt, the Fiend Bray Wyatt. Not the first shocking cut WWE has made this year. They've been cutting a lot of talent, including some big names, but definitely I would say the biggest of them all, the most shocking of them all. We have not seen Bray Wyatt on WWE television since the Firefly Funhouse segment that he did the night after WrestleMania. A WrestleMania where he lost to Randy Orton. This man was burnt to a crisp in their Inferno match in December at TLC. Came back at WrestleMania and lost to Randy Orton. The PW Insider at the time reported that it was a match that he was originally scheduled to win. But that weekend, for whatever reason, it got changed to him losing. And ever since, Bray hasn't really said much on social media. WWE has been mum about why he was off TV. They don't talk about that kind of stuff. It was said to be due to a specific issue of some kind, but there was never any clarity on exactly what that issue was. It did not appear to be injury-related. You know, he was seen supposedly backstage at different tapings sometimes, but he was never used. There was a report online that I never fully believed, given that it was never reported by anybody that I would consider reputable, that he may have still had trouble coping with the death of Brody Lee, which did hit him very hard. As you would expect that it would, the two of them were very tight. They were very close. They worked together. They were very good friends. And I can understand that, being a very difficult thing to go through. But this report that was going around was talking about how he just hasn't been able to get over it, and it's a mental health issue. First of all, I don't know that to be the case. Nobody would. Except Bray Wyatt. Mike Johnson of PW Insider, though, provided more information into the reason why all of this happened. And it's every bit as ridiculous as you would think. PW Insider has confirmed with multiple sources that WWE chose to release Bray Wyatt, and that the word going around was that it was a budget-related reason, similar to other big cuts such as Braun Strowman. It was not a case of Wyatt asking to be released. We are told that Wyatt was called by John Laurinaitis and informed it was simply a budgetary decision and not something that Wyatt had done. So the old, it's not you, it's me. They gave him the it's not you, it's me excuse. To say that the reaction within the company was stunned would be a massive understatement given how plugged into licensing the Wyatt character has been in recent years. The Fiend had been a massive hit for t-shirts and action figures. One source pointed the finger squarely at WWE President Nick Khan and CFO Christina Salen, stating that they are obsessed with the company not being even one iota in the red on the financial ledgers, that even after the most recent financial quarter, there had to have been a push to cut costs where, with previous regimes, there would have been more leniency. Others noted that Wyatt and Vince McMahon's relationship behind the scenes ran very hot and cold at times, and that McMahon has given Khan the ability to run things far more than anyone else has historically been able to accomplish. So there was likely less of a pushback over the idea of cutting a big money contract from the ledger. Between this story, this move, and the tone-deaf, stupid comment that Vince McMahon made on the earnings call the other day about sending more talent to AEW, because he was asked a question about AEW, and so he gave an answer about them, and he was talking about how I don't know what their mindset is or what their plans are, but maybe we'll give them some more talent. However sarcastic he may have thought he was being, and I'm going to get into all that later. If you are a WWE roster member, if you are a performer under contract to WWE, I hope this serves as an example that no matter how hard you work, no matter how much effort you put into your character, whatever ideas you may have come up with to try to better yourself and to try to succeed and to try to move up, no matter how bulletproof you think you may be, no matter how fat your contract may be, or how long it may be for, however many years you may have on your contract, you are all expendable. Every single one of you are expendable. And WWE does not care. You are a number. You are a cog in the wheel. And if it's a case of saving a few bucks just to make sure we stay in the black and not in the red, doesn't matter how big of a name you are. It doesn't matter what you've done or what you've accomplished. Merch you've sold. Any of that. This is a prime example here. It doesn't matter. They do not care. And Bray Wyatt is not an exclusive case. He is just another victim of wasted talent in the creative wasteland that is WWE. And I say that even as Bray Wyatt has given me, as a fan, at least two of my favorite WWE memories, probably in the last, at least the last decade. It wasn't all bad with Bray. But to have someone like that, and to let him go so easily, like a janitor, is deplorable. It is deplorable. You look at his career in WWE once he was called up from NXT, when he came in with the cult leader character, the Wyatt family, it was him, it was Luke Harper, it was Eric Rowan. They worked well together. It was a unique character. He had completely reinvented himself. You know, the Fiend is not the first time that Wyndham Rotunda has gone and reinvented himself to try to hit on something that works and to be successful. He was doing the Husky Harris thing. Obviously, that wasn't going anywhere. And so he ended up trying this new character in NXT, and it worked. And it took off in NXT, and you never know, you know, once you hit the main roster, if it's going to work, if Vince McMahon is going to believe in it and get behind it. But at first, it seemed like he had really hit on something pretty successful. And you fast forward to the beginning, the end of 2013 into the beginning of 2014. That's always the period that I look at. That's always the period that I remember and that I am most fond of. Because you had the whole angle they did where Daniel Bryan had to join the Wyatt family. And it wasn't a long partnership. It wasn't a long union. But they were together for a period of several weeks. But it built to a steel cage match. It was a tag team match with Wyatt and Bryan against the Usos on an episode of Raw in January of 2014, only, I think, a couple of weeks or a few weeks before the Royal Rumble. And I couldn't tell you much about what happened in the actual match itself. I couldn't tell you if it was a good match. I couldn't tell you if it was a shit match. Because it's not about the match. It's about what the match built to. It was about the post-match. And you guys have heard me talk about this moment and praise this moment. I think I've ranked it on some lists I've done on the podcast over the years. When that match was over, the people in that building badly wanted Daniel Bryan to snap out of it. He was almost like in this trance-like state. They wanted him to snap out of it and break free from the chains of the Wyatt family. And part of the reason this worked so well, if not a big part of the reason it worked so well, is because Bryan was so beloved. And this was right in that period where they were getting behind him. He was sort of the anti-authority figure on the roster, the underdog. The company really wasn't getting behind. But they, after a while, heading into WrestleMania, they had no choice, right? Punk left. And they anointed Bryan as the champion, and he ended up in that spot that he was in the main event of WrestleMania. But he was so beloved, they just wanted to see him break free. And I remember that scene like it was yesterday of him in the cage, and it looked like he was going to be subservient again to Bray. Bray was going to give him a Sister Abigail. And he escaped, and he stood there, and the place came unglued. And you had Bryan in one corner, you had Wyatt in the other, there was nobody else in the ring. And they pan out, and you see everybody is standing on their feet. And when Bray goes to attack him, Bryan ducks, and he starts firing away. Daniel Bryan is back. He's firing off with shotgun drop kicks in the corner. This building, it looked on television like it was shaking. These people were going out of their minds. And he shed the skin of the Wyatt family. He took off the overalls, whatever it was, the outfit that he was wearing. Harper's trying to get in, Rowan's trying to get in, Brian's knocking him down. And this was the first time that I can recall, in the middle of all of this yes stuff, this is the first time when Bryan went in the corner and started putting his fingers up in the air, very slowly. He was getting, and of course, he built up more and more speed. Yes, yes, yeah, and the camera panned out. And you just get this view of the entire arena, however many people were in there, 8,000 people, 10,000 people, all on their feet, putting their hands, putting their fingers in the air. The sad part is Bryan doesn't remember any of this because he got concussed. That's probably the only thing about the match itself I remember. He got concussed and supposedly has no memory and no recollection of any of this. One of his great moments in his WWE career, he hit the knee to Bray, he climbed the cage, he's sitting on top of the cage 10 feet up, obviously concussed to all hell. But it was one of the greatest moments in the history of Monday Night Raw. I don't just mean in the history 10, 15 years, all time. One of the great moments in Monday Night Raw history. And Wyatt was part of that moment. Then came the Royal Rumble match, which I maintain is still the best singles match of Bray Wyatt's entire career. No surprise, right? It came against Daniel Bryan. It was a hell of a match. Bray won. And from there came the second moment that I was referring to before, which was this brief program. It wasn't very long. It wasn't an extended program. But it was a program between The Shield, which up to that point had been a heel faction, and the Wyatt family. The fans just gravitated to it. They thought it was so cool to see these two factions facing off. And when they got to the Elimination Chamber pay-per-view, before they even were in the ring together, before they touched, you had people on their feet chanting, "This is awesome." Then the match came. And you wonder, well, can the match live up to the billing here? The answer is yes. They had a fantastic match. They told a great story. The people were into it. The way that The Shield at the end there, Roman Reigns was left all alone. He had to fend for himself, but it was too much. He was overcome. And Bray Wyatt got the pin. The Wyatt family got the win. One of my favorite WWE matches of all time was that first meeting between the two teams at that pay-per-view. Now, they had two more matches in the weeks that followed on TV, one on Raw and one on Main Event, of all things. But it's that first meeting that they had on pay-per-view that, to me, is the most memorable. It just felt like Bray was, at that point, firing on all cylinders. And then he met a brick wall at WrestleMania 30 by the name of John Cena. And it felt like the wheels just came off the car. At that point, that was the beginning of what I would call the Eater of Pins era. Remember that? Remember the Eater of Pins? He wasn't the eater of worlds, he became the eater of pins. In nearly every big match, not every single one, but nearly every big match situation that he would be in for months after that, into the following year, it was almost to the point of comedy, like you would think it's being done on purpose. He would be cutting all of these spooky promos on his opponents, whoever he was going to be facing, whether it was Cena, whether it was Undertaker and Kane, or whoever it was, Randy Orton. And then invariably, he would lose. And he would be made to look like a fucking fool. It was so bad, one of my listeners at the time even put together a video that I shared of every single instance where Bray would cut a scary promo threatening one of his opponents, immediately followed up by a clip of him losing and being pinned or being dumped out of the ring of the Royal Rumble. After a while, you start to wonder how you're supposed to take somebody like this seriously. They talk a big talk, but when push comes to shove, they don't deliver. But the most egregious example, which I mentioned the Royal Rumble, the most egregious example of Vince McMahon not giving a fuck what the fans want, taking a leak on our heads and telling us it's raining outside, was the Royal Rumble match in 2015, one of the most god-awful pieces of shit that I have ever seen. Bray Wyatt was one of many victims in that match, dumped out of the ring by Kane and Big Show like a sack of garbage. That's what he was treated like. Daniel Bryan, let's get him out of the match early so that everybody can get all the rage out of their systems before Roman Reigns comes out to win the entire thing. One by one they fell. Bray Wyatt, Dolph Ziggler, Dean Ambrose. No great dramatic finish, no creativity or effort put in whatsoever. Bray Wyatt looked like a chump. But then I think of the new Wyatt family storyline. A couple of years after that, actually late 2016 into the beginning of 2017, where Randy Orton joined the Wyatt family in the match that should have been at WrestleMania 33. Because I was enjoying that storyline. It was a great story that they were telling. And I mentioned Brody Lee earlier, who had his own issues with WWE and his own frustrations that he was vocal about. As much as he enjoyed the people that he met and the people he worked with, I can remember him, whether it was on Chris Jericho's podcast or other shows, just talking about his own experiences and how frustrating it was for him. He would be promised things that then weren't delivered, or they would tell him one thing, but then it would turn out to be a different thing. And all he wanted to do was show them what he could do in the ring. He just wanted to show them that he could contribute. They did put the Intercontinental title on Harper at one point. It was, again, brief. I can remember that ladder match where he and Dolph Ziggler killed each other. But they hit on this storyline where the one person in the Wyatt family who was very suspect of Randy Orton and his intentions and could see what was going on here and the manipulation that was going on here was Luke Harper. We knew it as the viewer. Luke Harper knew it. But it didn't seem like Bray knew it. Rowan didn't seem to know it. If Rowan was even part of the group still at that point, I don't remember timeline was if he was still with them, but I was digging the storyline and it was building to a match between Orton and Wyatt or Orton and Harper rather. But I was hopeful that they would add Luke Harper and make it a triple threat match at WrestleMania because Bray went to the Elimination Chamber and he won. That was actually one of the better Elimination Chamber matches they've done in recent years. And he won the WWE Championship, only for them to turn around at WrestleMania and for him to drop it to Randy Orton. Luke Harper deserved a spot in that match. I'm not saying he should have won the title, but he was every bit a part of that storyline as the other two guys were. And that was another missed opportunity to get him in a match where it's not a charity case, storyline-wise. He deserved to be in that match. As it was, the match between Orton and Wyatt sucked. It was no good. But then you fast forward to the summer of 2019. All these vignettes that have been airing on TV for months. We had no idea what this was. It was the debut of The Fiend. It was the Firefly Funhouse. It was something out of the mind of Bray Wyatt. Something that he had come up with on his own. Something that he had concocted. All of the creative effort that went into that character, which was unlike anything that I had ever seen before on WWE television. It was unique. I'll say that much. I didn't quite know what to make of it at first. But there would be little, you know, like attention to detail, whether it was with the puppets or something that was on the wall or a reference that he would make. You could tell there was a lot of effort that was put into this, a lot of forethought that was put into this, which is atypical when it comes to WWE storytelling. You don't always get that level of storytelling in this company, but you could tell that he was so invested in this character and he put so much effort into this to make this thing work. The money he spent out of his own pocket, supposedly, on the mask and the costuming and everything that went into it to try to make that character work. And then that debut entrance at SummerSlam for the match against Finn Balor. What a fucking entrance that was. With the lantern, the music. Like I said, unlike anything that this company had ever done before. And he had a dominant win over Finn Balor, and it's like, they have potentially a new monster here on their hands. Now, we know in storyline, okay, obviously it's Bray Wyatt. There were any number of ways they could have gone with this. The story, the way I always looked at it, the story was very simple. This is a guy who lost his marbles. It's not so much a guy who's out there playing magic tricks as much as it's a guy who has gone off the deep end, like the Joker. And he has created, he has manufactured this whole world for himself, this whole creepy universe. And you look at some of the booking of his character over the years, and you can understand why he would be so frustrated. And he would go off the deep end. I'd go off the fucking deep end, too. People still ask me. They still ask me. And it's still one of my highest viewed reviews on YouTube. About my Hell in a Cell rant from 2019. When The Fiend was still fresh. He had only just debuted a couple of months before this. The match with Balor was 2 months before. And they put him in a Universal Championship match inside Hell in a Cell with Seth Rollins. And I felt it was too soon for something like that. It felt to me like they were going to that well too quickly. They were boxing themselves into a corner because either he wins the title right away, or he doesn't. And if he doesn't, you've already damaged the aura of that character. How are you going to have The Fiend go in there and lose? You don't kill it, but you damage it by doing that. And so what did they do? You all know what they did. They took a shit right in the middle of the ring, and they told the fans, here, enjoy the stench. I'll never forget Sean Waltman's reaction watching that on the live watch-along they did on YouTube. Waltman was all of us that night. I don't even know that he's been invited back for one of those since. But they did that. They put that horrible match together with that horrible finish, only to turn around a few weeks later in Saudi Arabia because it was so important to wait those extra 3 weeks and piss off your entire fan base in the process with that pay-per-view finish. And they put the championship on him then. And then, in February of last year, The Fiend was dealt a fatal blow when he lost the Universal title to Bill Goldberg at Sweet Saudi Money 5, staying alive in Saudi Arabia. He won the title in Saudi Arabia. He lost the title in Saudi Arabia in less than 3 minutes. In 3 minutes, The Fiend was killed dead. The aura, the mystique, no effort to preserve any of it. You could argue, well, there are ways for him to lose but still look strong and dominant in the process. None of it. Because it didn't matter to them. He wasn't the important figure. The important figure was Roman Reigns. The important figure wasn't even Bill Goldberg. Bill Goldberg was just, he was a transitional champion. He was a tool to get belt off The Fiend so they can get it on this other guy. So they could do their Battle of the Spears at WrestleMania, which ended up not even happening. The aura, the mystique, all of it fed to Goldberg, who got over in 1998. It was that important to take one of your newer characters and tear it down. It was so important to do that. He was never the same after that. Not to me. Did the Firefly Funhouse match at WrestleMania because of COVID. Had to come up with something unique. It was unique. It was like, I think I described it as being on an acid trip. Not that I have ever been on an acid trip, but I would imagine if I was, it would be something like that. I don't know what to make of that. I enjoyed the Boneyard match more, but I didn't hate it either. It was definitely something different. He technically got a win over John Cena, but I don't look at that as an official match. But by last summer, I was already soured on the Fiend stuff. I was done. That Goldberg match, and just the way it was handled, for me, really killed it. And then they started the stuff with Alexa Bliss. It was 1 year ago. Then he won the title from Braun Strowman, then he lost it, a week later, to Roman Reigns. Then came the feud with Randy Orton, which was the cure for insomnia. I will not say anything positive about the majority of that feud. I'm not going to sit here and pretend it was something great. It fucking sucked. It built to the Inferno match. Like I said earlier, he got burned. And I gave them credit at the time. I said, you know, we've seen a certain number of Inferno matches in wrestling over the years, going back to the one with Undertaker and Kane at Unforgiven back in 98. And, you know, it makes for a great visual. It makes usually for a shitty match, but it's a great visual. At least they delivered on the stipulation. I mean, they had to play some camera magic to make it work, which they could do because they were in the Thunderdome. But we actually got to see someone, kind of, burned alive. At least they delivered on the stipulation. I'll give them that. Then we didn't see him again. And at WrestleMania, he came back for the match against Randy Orton, and he lost. He lost off of a distraction by Alexa Bliss. And what ended up happening is, aside from the one appearance on TV the next night, we haven't seen or heard from him since, but Alexa Bliss continued on in this role. They effectively gave the Fiend character to Alexa Bliss to make it her own. All the work and the effort and the money this man had put into that character, which had already effectively been killed off, but just handed over to somebody else. Remember the comment I made on the podcast a few months ago? When she started to really go heavy into all the hocus pocus stuff, the Fiend is back. Only difference is the Fiend now pees sitting down instead of standing up. Alexa Bliss became the new Fiend. She created her own version of the Fiend. I saw that when the news came out yesterday, Mickie James Aldis tweeted, "I think what you meant to say," this is in response to the WWE's tweet about letting him go. "I think what you meant to say was, thank you so much for coming up with such an incredible gimmick, time and time again, one so cool and over we really didn't know how to book it right. So we just gave it to someone else so we can make all the money off of it still and let you go." She says, "This isn't against Alexa. I love her. She's an incredible performer who's killing it in a role that she was given. She always does. We as artists take every role that we're given and turn it into gold. He, she, they both did that, like it or not. Facts are facts. Sorry if that offends you." And I will chime in on the Alexa defense here. I do not like this Lily shit with the doll. I think it's fucking stupid. I think all of this has overstayed its welcome. I am by no means a fan of all the Alexa Bliss magic and all the bullshit that they're still doing on television. But I've never criticized Alexa as far as from a performance angle. The stuff that she does, she knocks it out of the park. She's very good in the role. She does what she's told to do. She delivers it in a great way, exactly the way they want it to be. She's all in on the role. She does a great job with it. Doesn't mean it doesn't suck. Mickey is dead on in her tweet. And I'll guarantee you she's not the only person in that company, although she's not in the company anymore, but I guarantee you she's not the only person on that WWE roster who's probably friendly with Bray, who feels the same way. So the question now is, what happens with Bray Wyatt? What does the future hold for Wyndham Rotunda? Does he even want to continue wrestling? I don't know. Until he makes a comment, none of us can get into his head. We don't know what his goals are. We don't know what he wants to do with the next several years of his life. I assume he's going to be bound by a 90-day non-compete, but he hasn't been on television in months. For all we know, WWE can freeze his contract. I have no idea how this is going to play out. Nobody does. Naturally, there's going to be a lot of people who say Tony Khan should swoop right in and pick him up. Come on, man. He's a big name. He can fit right in AEW. You know, right now we're all talking about CM Punk and we're talking about Daniel Bryan and they just got Malakai Black and they got Andrade. And you do run the risk of WWE fatigue. At some point, your roster is so bloated and you start bringing in so much talent that it becomes too much. But I'm not going to sit here and say he doesn't deserve an opportunity to go work somewhere else and show what he can do. Does he come up with an entirely new character? Obviously, he wouldn't be able to call himself Bray Wyatt. Does he reinvent himself for the third time? He's had at least two reinventions in his career. Does he come up with another character altogether? I don't know. I'm curious how in another company he might pull off something like that, because we might get a better sense then of whether or not he deserves more of the blame for why things fizzled out with The Fiend the way they did. I'm willing to bet the company had more to do with that than he did, and he probably feels the same way that a lot of people felt. The way they booked that character sometimes. It had to eat him alive inside because of all the effort that he put into it. So I would be very curious to see him land in an AEW or some other company with a similar type of character, just to see if he can pull it off and if he can be even more successful with it, or if it fizzles out and it turns out to be a dud and he gets exposed. He deserves an opportunity as much as anybody else if that's what he wants to do. There's a lot of different companies he can go work for. AEW is probably the biggest of the bunch outside of WWE. Certainly not something I would be bringing him in next week. But do I think if I'm Tony Khan, I would have a conversation with him if he was interested and give him a look? Absolutely. And the natural idea would be the Dark Order. If and when the Dark Order was to go heel again, because after what happened with Brody Lee, I said it would be very hard to envision the Dark Order being heel and getting booed. But if Wyatt was the one to come in and kind of take the mantle of this dark faction, they're not even really that dark. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, it's more of a comedy group now, and the word dark is in the name, but there's nothing overly dark about the Dark Order. If they wanted to take it in a dark direction, the one person who could probably do that is Bray Wyatt, under whatever new name he might use. And it would mean something given the connection that group has to Brody Lee and the connection that he had to Brody Lee. And I'm not even sure that's something he would want to do. He might look at that and think it was disrespectful. Who knows? Again, we don't know what's going through his mind. But do I think him coming into AEW maybe months down the road and taking the mantle of that group, taking it in a totally different direction, could work? He's already proven that it could work. He's already led that type of faction in the past. Absolutely, it could work. In the spirit of what Brody Lee was doing with that group? Absolutely. But we just don't know yet exactly what his plans are. But this is just another in a long line of examples of talent squandered by WWE. For all the success that he had, WWE champion for a month, Universal champion twice, even if the second time was only for a week, tag team champion, he had a lot of moments in WWE. I said at the beginning, it wasn't all bad. But you have a talent like that, and you squander it. And you get to a point where we're going to let you go because of budget cuts. I said earlier, nobody in this company is bulletproof. Everybody is expendable. That's truer for more people than most. There's a select few who maybe that doesn't apply to as much. You think of somebody like a Roman Reigns, for example, or a Randy Orton or somebody like that. But, I look at his career and I look at all of the moments that he did have in 2014, in 2017, or 2019 with The Fiend. And here we are in 2021 and we're talking about John Laurinaitis calling this guy on the phone when he was getting ready to come back. By all accounts, he was ready to make a comeback in August. They had already booked him on some events. This was not somebody who wanted out. He wanted back in. You think he enjoyed sitting on the sidelines for the last 6 months? And to think that it all ended with a phone call from Johnny Ace saying, "Hey, it's not you, it's me. Sorry. No hard feelings." Let that be a message to every single person who works in that company. That is what WWE thinks of you. If it could happen to him, it could happen to any one of you. I'm very sorry to hear about Joey Jordison's death, one of the founding members of Slipknot, and Dusty Hill's death. And Dusty Hill was quite a bit older than Joey, but Dusty Hill of ZZ Top, they just kicked off a huge North American tour, and Dusty went down with a hip injury, apparently. They said that he would only be gone for a little bit, and then he would rejoin the band on the tour, and in the meantime, he had told the other band members, the show must go on. Well, not for him, it doesn't. It's very sad. And so is the death of Super Porky. Just to bring this back to wrestling here for a second, Super Porky, who died of a heart attack this week, he was a huge star in Mexico for many years, and only turned to a lot of the comedy stuff after his knees got totally shot. I don't even think he was my height. I'm 5'8". I'm a little over 5'8". I think he was maybe 5'6", or 5'7". Had to be close to 300 pounds, easily. That is going to wreck your knees. When you're carrying around that kind of weight at that height, that ain't good. But WWE used him in 2005 and 2006 on SmackDown as a comedy figure in their minis division. There was nothing mini about Super Porky. I don't even think ever wrestled an actual match for them. He just appeared in a few comedy segments on TV, and in 06, they disbanded the juniors division, and they let him go. And that was the end of his run there. But let's talk about AEW here, because this was a huge week for All Elite Wrestling. AEW hosted a very eventful episode of Dynamite on Wednesday, and you guys came out in force on the live stream. We had nearly 1,400 of you. Thank you for hanging out with me. Let's do it again this Wednesday. This was the third straight week Dynamite brought in over a million viewers, and TNT took time to gloat about it this week, issuing a press release touting it as Wednesday's number one cable program in the 18 to 49 demo for the third straight week. AEW had been promoting a major live event announcement, which turned out to be that week two of their Rampage show, their new Rampage show, which starts on Friday the 13th, week two of the show on August 20th is going to be airing from the 23,000 seat United Center in Chicago. 2 weeks before AEW invades the Chicago area for three straight shows, Dynamite, Rampage, and All Out, in early September, all of which are taking place at the smaller Now Arena, which is in a suburb of Chicago, almost an hour away. They have what they clearly believe is a big attraction for this August 20th Rampage for what they're calling the First Dance. That is the title they have trademarked for this event. And that attraction is CM Punk. Now, I did say on this podcast only a few weeks ago, before the Punk rumors even started, it was, I think, on the same show where I talked about Jimmy Uso's DUI arrest, that I thought they had outgrown the smaller venue in Chicago. I mean, it's nice to get 10 or 11,000 people in the building, but why limit yourself to 10 when you could do double that for a big show like All Out? You know, I said going forward they should book the United Center for all of their major shows. I understand that it's an expensive venue to run, like Madison Square Garden, which is why WWE doesn't run there as often. But even just once a year for All Out, I think it's the way to go. And now, they did it a lot quicker than I thought they would, and they did it for a live TV show on a Friday night. The Punk news leaking, or the Punk rumors, whatever you want to call it, leaking. And by the way, I'm not so sure that they didn't want it to leak. Now that we see what they're doing, it has me thinking they may have intentionally wanted this news to get out early. The Punk news was going to help a lot. But even without Punk, had they booked the United Center for All Out, I truly believe they could have easily gotten 15,000 people into the building for that show. Punk, you know, just handed them a gift. You look at that presale on Friday, good Lord. They moved over 12,000 tickets in the presale, with more held back for the general public on sale tomorrow. Now just think about this. That 1 hour Rampage show has a chance at becoming the highest attended non-WWE show in the United States since 1999. depending on how many seats they set it up for. I know the G1 Supercard at MSG a couple of years ago with Ring of Honor and New Japan. I was at that show. It was a packed house. They had over 16,000 people in the building that night. AEW may only be able to set up for 14 or 15,000. But they could potentially open it up to more. And if they do, and if they fill those seats up, that would be the new record for a non-WWE event in over 20 years. And then a month later, they're going to break their own record with their New York City debut at Arthur Ashe Stadium. So this is huge for them. This is huge for a company that is still growing and trying to show that they can fill the bigger arenas and the bigger venues, stadiums, and not just the smaller buildings. You know, with WWE, you come to expect it. It's still very impressive when they can pack 50,000 people in a stadium, but WWE has done that over and over again over a period of decades. You think of big events, WrestleMania 3, SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium. Now it's like Mania and sometimes the Rumble, and now SummerSlam every year. It's in some big dome or big stadium. They have over 40,000 sold for SummerSlam next month, or actually this month in a few weeks. So it's still impressive, but it's to be expected because they have a track record of doing that. For AEW, they're trying to start their own track record. And the company is only about 2 years old. So this is a huge deal for them, the fact that they are being able to put numbers up like this. Now, the only reason they would book Chicago 2 weeks before is to debut CM Punk and give themselves 2 weeks to promote his first match for All Out. It's what makes the most sense given this announcement and given the backstage segment that aired on Wednesday with Darby Allin saying that he'll be in Chicago and that a lot of men claim to be the greatest, but there's only one place to really prove that. That's in AEW. Even if you think you're the best in the world, they're not exactly being subtle about this. Punk will be there. You don't try to fill a bigger building on hype for CM Punk, which is clearly what they're doing. I mean, Tony Khan has been very coy when he has been asked about this, and he has not been shy about shooting down rumors he just did on Busted Open the other day. There was a report that he and the other EVPs had secretly flown on his private plane to Chicago or to the United Center to shoot some material for something. And he shot that down and said, this is bogus. I wasn't even in the same state with the other EVP. So when there's, you know, some kind of false report or rumor, he's not shy about shooting it down. The only thing he said about these rumors is, boy, these are interesting rumors and I really don't have any comment. I really can't comment on it. You know, he's being coy about it. You don't play off of that hype for CM Punk and then not deliver CM Punk. Not unless you want the murder rate in Chicago to spike even higher. So it's definitely happening. I believe that. And Darby Allin looks to be his first opponent. Darby is one of the five AEW names that Punk singled out earlier this year as names that he would like to work with if he ever came back to wrestling. It was Darby, Will Hobbs, Ricky Starks, Brian Pillman Jr., and Jungle Boy. Now, I like the match. I don't think it hurts Darby at all if he goes in there and loses to Punk in his first match back in Chicago. You know, debuting for Punk, debuting at the United Center has got to be special for him because he was in the building for the first show ever held at the United Center, which was the 1994 SummerSlam. And he was there for the big cage match between Bret and Owen Hart, which is one of his favorite matches. It's mine too. It's my favorite steel cage match of all time. Walking out to his music in that building after 7 years away, that has to mean something to him. Now, also on Dynamite this week, Hangman Adam Page and the Dark Order lost to the Elite in their 10-man tag elimination match with Omega pinning Hangman. That is now two pinfall wins for Omega over Adam Page going back to their Full Gear match last November. They tossed a hand grenade into Hangman's quest for the title, and in this week's Observer, Meltzer reports that Page is not getting the main event at All Out against Kenny Omega. He says at one point that was the plan, but plans change. I think it'll say that on Dave's tombstone after he dies. God wasn't planning to take him yet, but plans change. We'll see what they have in mind. Punk looks like if he wrestles it all out, it probably would be against Darby Allin. You know, Danielson, I'm hoping they save for the New York City show. I've seen Orange Cassidy's name mentioned. Christian Cage mentioned as a possibility for the main event at All Out. That would be underwhelming. I mean, even though I think the Christian match would be very good, I think a match with him and Omega would be a great idea. But to me, that's a big Dynamite match. That's not your main event at one of your biggest shows of the year. And I'm not saying they can't drag this Hangman story out a little bit longer. I mean, remember, I suggested Full Gear for the match originally. That was my original suggestion. 1 year later, you build up to a big Hangman win against Omega at Full Gear. And it could still happen. But here's what I'm wondering. Because this has me thinking. Maybe they're delaying the match a few weeks to the Arthur Ashe show. They could still have Proud and Powerful challenge the Bucks for the tag team titles on that show in Queens and win them. Doesn't mean that match has to headline. That could be the co-main event. You could headline with Hangman against Kenny Omega on what we already know is going to be the biggest show in AEW history. They're going to be putting their full promotional muscle behind it. They know they're going to get almost 20,000 people in the stadium that night. This is going to be huge show, perhaps their biggest Dynamite audience. I'm sure that's what they're going to be gunning for that night. Maybe that's the idea, to get as many eyeballs as possible at their biggest show ever and have the match there and have Hangman Page go over and become the champion. It's just something to ponder. You know, with Hangman, I don't want to see happen to him what happened to Braun Strowman 4 years ago when he was as popular as he had ever been. And they had a chance to belt him, and they didn't do it. And he never really recovered from that. I mean, not that he wasn't pushed ever again after that, but to me, he never regained that level of fan enthusiasm to see him become the champion and go all the way. Like, it's just, he never really recovered from that. Now, maybe I've just been so conditioned and abused by WWE booking over the years that I'm applying the same logic here in a situation where it doesn't apply. I trust that Tony Khan has a plan here. I may not always agree with that plan, but do I believe they have a long-term or longer-term vision? I mean, this story's been playing out now for probably a year or more, really, if you take it all the way back. I trust that Khan has a plan here, the way I usually trust that Triple H has a plan on NXT. And sometimes Vince McMahon will ruin those plans by calling one or two people up at the most inopportune time to the main roster. But I've said the same thing in the past about Triple H, where I kind of trust in the plan when it comes to their key people and their key storylines on NXT. I feel the same way about Tony Khan and the top stories in AEW. But I'm starting to think the real play here for this match may be a Hangman win in New York City. Lance Archer will defend his IWGP United States Championship at the New Japan Resurgence Show in LA on August 14th. And it will be against Hiroshi Tanahashi, the ace of New Japan, who appeared on Dynamite in a video message challenging the champion to a match. This will be Tanahashi's first match on U.S. soil since February of last year, so it will not be happening at an AEW event. But Jon Moxley cut a promo on Tanahashi later in the show, and with no obvious match for Moxley at All Out, it has me thinking that we still might get Tanahashi in an AEW ring sooner than later. You know, if AEW can get Punk and Tanahashi on that All Out show in separate matches, that's huge. You know, for the AEW audience who knows who these people are, they obviously know who Punk is. Any even casual wrestling fans, it's been 7 years, but they know who CM Punk is. Tanahashi, yeah, I mean, if you talk to casual WWE fans, they may not know who the hell that is, but I guarantee you the majority of the AEW audience, they've heard of Tanahashi. They know who a lot of those people are. To them, it would be a very big deal. Those would be two big attractions to get on that pay-per-view. Chris Jericho barely survived his second labor with a win over Nick Gage, who just had the biggest week of his life. His match with Matt Cardona was the talk of the internet for a few days. And then he goes and he debuts on national television wrestling Chris Jericho in the main event in front of 7,000 people. Jericho took more punishment than I expected him to. The guy hit a fucking Frankensteiner off the top rope, put Gage through a pane of glass. I don't much care for this type of shit, but I couldn't take my eyes off it either. Which I guess is what AEW was banking on. And it worked, since that main event did the highest numbers of the entire show. So if it was a turnoff for some people, wasn't enough of one to be reflected in the ratings. So Jericho won, and now in his third labor this Wednesday, he will have to wrestle his old rival from WCW, Juventud Guerrera. And Jericho has to hit a move off the top rope in order to win, which might have been a little more dramatic if we didn't already see him hit Frankensteiners in each of his last two matches. It appears what they're doing here is that we're getting Jericho from different eras in each of these matches. The first labor against Shawn Spears was, you know, just AEW Chris Jericho, leader of the Inner Circle, Le Champion, whatever you want to call him. Labor number two was New Japan Chris Jericho, dressed up as the Painmaker. Labor number three is going to be Lionheart Chris Jericho from WCW, Cruiserweight Chris Jericho, even if he doesn't quite meet the weight requirements anymore of the Cruiserweight division. But it looks like that's what they're going for. And that leaves one more labor before he gets MJF at All Out. So it'll probably be, and this is me guessing here, it'll probably be someone from his Y2J or early WWE run, or it could be somebody like Paul White, who tagged with Jericho for a while. He's under contract to AEW. He is going to wrestle. He just hasn't had a match yet. You know, Jericho had a damn good run. I will die on that hill. I thought they had a damn good run. It wasn't planned that way. It was Jericho and Edge, if you remember, as the tag team champions on SmackDown. And then Edge got hurt. He blew out his Achilles. But Jericho and Big Show were a good team. I call him Amish Big Show because he looked Amish to me during that run. But that's my guess about the fourth labor. First, he has to get past the Juice. The Juice is 46 years old now. I have not seen him wrestle since his run with the Mexicools in WWE. I wonder how much juice he's got left. And I said this on Wednesday. The thing about AEW I give them credit for that makes them stand out from WWE, even though they sign a lot of WWE people, and it's not like everything they do is completely different, but they do enough different. They give you a little bit of everything on the show. WWE has its formula. They don't like straying from that formula. There is a sameness to a lot of their shows. I don't have as much of that same issue with AEW, which is not to say I'm a fan of everything they do, but you know, one minute you'll have Nick Gage, case in point, right? Nick Gage taking a fucking pizza cutter, trying to maim Chris Jericho. And then in another, they're teasing an interpromotional wrestling match between someone from AEW and someone from New Japan. Or they'll have the NWA Women's Champion make an appearance and defend her title on the show. Or, you know, whatever it may be. They have an open borders policy with other promotions that makes things a little more interesting. Now you throw in the debuts for Punk and for Danielson, and this could be a really fun end of the summer for them. But I want to go back to that main event, because the story does not end there. Nick Gage wrestled one match on AEW television, and already there's controversy. One thing that AEW probably should have banked on is that there might be some blowback from at least one of their sponsors to all of the violence and the blood and everything from the main event on Wednesday. And it looks like that sponsor turned out to be Domino's Pizza. At the very moment that Nick Gage took a pizza cutter to Chris Jericho's forehead, they cut to a picture-in-picture break with an advertisement for Domino's. Now, supposedly it was not intentional, but I don't know that I buy that. The timing was just too perfect. Too perfect. But where the controversy comes into play is the website Front Office Sports, which I had never even heard of before this week. They ran a story with the headline, Domino's Disavows AEW's Bloody Pizza Cutter Spectacle on TNT. What a fucking headline. Here's the story. Domino's Pizza is disavowing any involvement or knowledge of All Elite Wrestling's bloody telecast in which one pro wrestler seemingly wielded a pizza cutter to slice his opponent's head open. The fast food giant might also pull its advertising schedule from AEW, which airs Wednesday nights on WarnerMedia's TNT network. Domino's was not involved, nor had any foreknowledge of the gory scene on the AEW Dynamite main event Wednesday night that showed wrestler Nick Gage apparently slicing Chris Jericho's head open with a pizza cutter, according to spokeswoman Jenny Fouracre Petko. She was the representative of Domino's that spoke to them on Thursday night. TNT followed the bloodstained AEW action with a commercial for the family-oriented pizza brand in which Domino's workers are seen slicing up a fresh pie for delivery. "We share the concerns expressed about this incident and the content of this TV-14 rated program and are assessing our advertising presence on it going forward." I saw Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer on its Twitter has offered to take the Domino's ad spots if they do pull out. Meltzer was kind of vague about this in The Observer, and I really think he needs to clarify this because he seemed to imply, which is a pretty serious thing to imply, that WWE was reaching out to AEW sponsors behind the scenes, including Domino's, as a way to cause trouble. And look, it's not like there aren't stories of Vince McMahon doing stuff like this going back over 30 years, ever since he went national. One of my favorites is him trying to sabotage the Super Clash main event between Jerry Lawler and Kerry Von Erich by filing an injunction with the State Athletic Commission right before the show, alerting them that Kerry was missing a foot. And because of some obscure law they had on the books that no wrestler or fighter, boxer, whatever, could compete or perform if they were missing a limb, he tried to get them shut down. He tried to stop the match from happening, which didn't work. So, you know, in this case, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Maybe it was someone else in WWE who tried to stir things up. Voices of Wrestling, they outright said that WWE has been calling journalists in hopes that the deathmatch stuff would pick up steam, and it really hasn't. No advertiser, not even Domino's yet, has actually pulled any money from their advertising with AEW. It's all talk. It's all bluster right now. On Friday night, reporter David Bixenspan, he dropped a story on his Babyface versus Heel website, which is by no means confirmation of anything, and he says as much, but he posted a story claiming that a reporter from a mainstream publication spoke to him and stated to him that WWE had contacted them about writing an article on the Domino's AEW situation. And the reporter provided Bixenspan with a screenshot of that exchange as proof. And he agreed not to share it publicly. You know, because look, in journalism, you sometimes have to agree to conditions like that to get the information that you're looking for. Being in public relations, I many times have agreed to provide information to reporters on background, which is different than off the record. So they could publish the information, but they couldn't publicly disclose that it was me who shared it with them. And that's only because typically that's the way the client wants it, so that's the way we have to do it. But, you know, these kinds of practices, they happen all the time. That doesn't make it fake news. But he also points out how peculiar it was, and I thought the exact same thing, that Domino's has not said a word to anyone else. They have not provided any kind of statement to another website, to a magazine, to a newspaper, on social media, nothing. Just this one website. They quoted this woman in their story. She is the director of public relations for Domino's. She's not some made-up person. But if you are in PR, as she is, you've got a statement ready in these situations. You've got a statement ready that you are either A, blasting out on blind copy to your list of websites and trade journals, or B, you've got a statement that you've drafted, saved and ready to go in the event that you are contacted by a journalist looking for a quote that they can use. I mean, that's just standard practice. And Domino's has been radio silent outside of this one article. Even people that have reached out to them for further comment, they have said nothing. So what I think may have happened is this reporter reached out to Domino's, which gave them a very boilerplate, very generic statement. Domino's then saw all of the blowback they got on social media from people, and they decided to keep quiet and just wait for this whole thing to blow over. Nowhere in their statement did they say they were pulling the ads. So I am willing to bet that come this Wednesday, you're probably going to see Domino's advertising on Dynamite. But the reason that this is all so rich, that WWE would try to fuck with AEW by going to its sponsors, is that it happened the same week Vince McMahon brushed off the idea that AEW was any kind of real competition. WWE reported its second quarter earnings this week, over $265 million in revenue, $29 million in profit, right? Big numbers. But what made headlines was a question that was directed at Vince McMahon about AEW, asking whether he sees them as competition and whether he sees the need to counter them by investing in more talent, since they may eventually compete against each other for media rights. Is it a situation, this person asked, like the late 90s, where a rising tide lifts all ships? This is what Vince McMahon had to say. It's certainly not a situation with rising tides, because that was when Ted Turner was coming after us with all of Time Warner's assets. That was a different situation. AEW is where they are. I really don't know what their plans are. All I know is what our plans are. I don't consider them competition in the way that I would consider WCW back in the day. Not anywhere near close to that. I'm not so sure what their investments are as far as their talent is concerned, but perhaps we can give them some more. And his voice sort of trailed off at that point where it was hard to understand him because he's fucking old. It happens to all of us. So Slick Nick Khan stepped in, and he tried to clean up Grandpa's answer a little bit. He's a smooth operator, this guy, I gotta say. When you really listen to him speak, this Nick Khan, that's probably why he's doing more and more of the talking, and Vince is doing less and less. But Khan said they consider everything, and I've heard him give this answer before, they consider everything to be competition to them. Not just any one company, and that even sleep is their competition. If that's the case, then sleep is winning, at least on Monday nights. Sleep is like WCW during the Monday Night War, 83 weeks and counting. I will defend Vince in this one regard, and only one. When WCW was breathing down his neck, WWE was near bankruptcy. In 1997, the company came very close to going under. That's where the famous story comes from, that Vince went to Bret Hart on that big 20-year contract he signed the year before and said, look, I can't afford to pay you on your contract. And I'm going to breach it, and I'm going to give you a permission slip, basically, to go talk to Ted Turner and Eric Bischoff and negotiate something with WCW. Can't pay you. Things were very bad. You know, Jim Cornette has told the story, and I don't know if this was in 97 or 96, but it was somewhere around there. When they were really cutting costs, he told the story it was so bad that in the tower, in Titan Tower, they had to remove the water coolers. They came in one day and the water coolers were either gone or they were being taken out. Things were bad. WCW was crushing them in the ratings. They were outpacing them on pay-per-view buys. They were stealing their talent. New guys were jumping ship to WCW every week, it felt like. Vince McMahon's back was up against the wall in a way that it had never been before. He probably felt like it was life and death for he and his company, because it was. Today, WWE is a juggernaut. They just generated $265 million in revenue. They have billion-dollar deals with Fox and Peacock and NBC Universal. He is not threatened by AEW in the same exact way that he was threatened by WCW. That is true. I believe that he believes that. Eric Bischoff, he openly talked about wanting to put WWE out of business. Tony Khan is not going around talking about how he wants to put WWE and Vince McMahon out of business. Quite the opposite. He talks about the forbidden door. I mean, my God, they talk about this forbidden door so much. But they talk about the forbidden door and wanting to do business with all different promotions. And I could just picture Vince McMahon probably looking at that and just laughing. And looking at this guy as some kind of lightweight. He's not cutthroat enough. He's too nice. He's too soft. But that does not mean that they are not still competition and that WWE does not view them as such. Of course they do. Of course they do. you know, the comment about, well, maybe we'll give them some more talent. It is such an arrogant fucking thing to say. Maybe you wouldn't have to give them the talent if you actually knew how to use them properly in the first fucking place. And for this to come of all weeks, with the Bray Wyatt news breaking, I wonder what the WWE roster thought, hearing a comment like that as they fired another one this weekend, due to budget cuts. But yeah, let's make a joke about it. AEW is 100% competition to WWE, because they are going to be competing for media rights in the next 3 to 5 years. Especially if AEW can keep up the momentum that they have been building of late. Even if AEW can only grow Dynamite to, let's say, 1.5 million viewers a week. Let's say they never hit 2 million. They never topple Raw, even though the gap is closed a little bit, especially in the demos. But let's say they hit 1.5 million at some point, and that's about as good as it gets. Okay? And they never overtake Monday Night Raw. My prediction is that they're going to double or triple their TV rights fees regardless, after this current deal with Warner is up. Whether it's Warner that renews or it's a totally different company remains to be seen. They're going to double or triple their money. Content is king. Think about how awful some of these WWE shows have been over the past few years, mainly on Mondays, and how their numbers have shrunk. Look at the numbers year over year. And they still got $1 billion each. It's because networks are paying stupid high numbers for sports rights. So there's not a doubt in my mind. If AEW is getting, what are they getting? I think it's just under $45 million a year, right? It's somewhere in that range. $175 million is what they got on their current deal. They'll easily double or triple that next time. Because now they are a proven commodity. Before, Warner took a leap of faith on them. They had no track record. They're a startup. And so far, it's paid off for them. They should have no problem getting more money. You don't think WWE doesn't view them as competition? They also draw from the same talent pool. How big do you think the pro wrestling talent pool is relative to other sports, baseball, football, basketball, worldwide, globally? I mean, I know you have a lot of independent shows and people who put on a pair of tights and think they're a wrestler, but realistically, relatively speaking, the pro wrestling talent pool is not exactly gigantic. There is a finite number of people that are in that pool. WWE and AEW, they are drawing talent, they're scouting talent from the same pool. And when AEW signs a talent that WWE may have had an interest in or may have had their eye on, you don't think they don't view AEW as competition for that talent? They didn't see AEW as competition when they started doling out high six-figure deals to re-sign people like Scott Dawson and Dash Wilder? Or Luke Gallows and Karl Anderson? Do you remember what they were even doing with those guys on television at the time? If they were even on TV? You expect me to believe that they did that because they valued their talent so much? Give me a fucking break. There is a bravado or an arrogance to the way they talk about these things, at least publicly. I'm not saying they should be out there praising AEW, but there's just a certain arrogance in the way they talk about these things that is going to come back to bite them on the ass sooner than people think. It's like when they used to deny that UFC was competition. Oh, they're not competition. One's a real sport and the other one isn't. You don't think WWE wasn't paying attention to the dates of those UFC pay-per-views and staying as far away from them as possible because of the audience crossover between the two? They can publicly deny it all they want, but their actions say otherwise. Vince McMahon may be able to fool Wall Street into believing these things because they're too fucking stupid to know any better. They just see the numbers. They don't know from any of this other stuff. But to everybody else, these people aren't dumb. They see things for what they are. Last week, I talked about the Vince McMahon steroid trial in the history segment, so this was a very timely story to read about, and very odd. Of all the things you would think WWE would want to draw attention to, WWE and Blumhouse Television, Blumhouse usually produces horror films, they produced the Halloween Kills sequel that's actually coming out in October. Now they're jumping into the ring with WWE to produce a limited scripted series called The United States of America versus Vince McMahon, billed as the first ever scripted dramatic portrayal of a chapter in WWE's history. The show will delve into WWE during the 1990s. At the time, Rupert Murdoch had purchased the New York Post to further his massive infiltration into the U.S. media landscape. For years, infamous Post writer Phil Mushnick regularly hammered... Well, there's your villain right there. Regularly hammered WWE chairman and CEO Vince McMahon in his column. Headlines like, "Legislators give WWE a free pass on roids," and "McMahon skips through the cemetery," eventually captured the attention of the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York, the nation's most prestigious federal prosecutor's office with a conviction rate of over 96%. In 1994, the U.S. government indicted McMahon for allegedly supplying anabolic steroids to WWE talent. McMahon, with his liberty at stake, two school-age children at home, and with WWE on the brink of bankruptcy, refused to take a plea deal. Ultimately, McMahon stood trial and was acquitted unanimously by a jury of his peers, and went on to build a multi-billion dollar global sports entertainment empire. Oh my goodness. What a description. What a heroic story. And I love it. It lists Vince McMahon himself and Kevin Dunn are among the executive producers of this series. You know, it's interesting. This trial, which is almost 30 years old, is also getting the Dark Side of the Ring treatment later this year. They even interviewed Jerry McDevitt for it. I suspect that this is going to have a very different slant than the Dark Side episode. I mean, just based on this description, this will have a very different slant than the Dark Side of the Ring episode will. But I will be here to cover them both. And then we will be able to make a determination about which one we think sounds more accurate. Basically, the government put forth a weak case. They charged him with something they couldn't actually prove. And Vince McMahon went on to be acquitted, and he framed the story as if he was unfairly maligned by the U.S. government, and he beat the government, and he persevered. And the reality is, Vince McMahon was no hero in this story. I know he probably looks at this that way, but it's not a story that makes WWE or wrestling look good at all. But I am sure they will take creative license with it and give us their version of events. You know, as they say, never forget the old saying, history is written by the winners. We learned that after WCW went out of business. I just want to know what Stephanie McMahon thinks of this whole thing. We all remember how traumatized, clearly, she was. Just based on what she said in the aftermath of the 9/11 attack. She was one of the first people we saw on TV that night on that first SmackDown. We're coming up on the 20-year anniversary. She sat there on television and compared what her family and her father went through during that trial when the government tried to tear their family apart. But they persevered. She tried to compare that to how the nation will come back after the terror attacks of 9/11. Amazing.
Did you watch Raw on Monday?
Did you watch Raw on Monday?
No, I never watched Raw. Why would I want to watch Raw?
Raw this week centered around the new Raw Women's Champion, Nikki A.S.H., and the greatest of all time bow down to the queen, Charlotte Flair. And Rhea Ripley is still there too, by the way. Still no Becky Lynch. Now I'm reading that she may be bound for the blue brand, which I guess makes sense because Seth is there, but man, they could really use her on this show right about now. The week before, Nikki cashed in her Money in the Bank contract on Charlotte to win the title. This week, she got the Rey Mysterio treatment as champion. I don't know about you guys. I find the almost a superhero stuff to be absolutely insufferable. But I am also not an 8-year-old girl, right? I am clearly not the audience for this, I will readily admit. But I find it insufferable. She talked about how she came to realize that if she fails, she fails. It's not a big deal, because I'm still me. If that was true, you'd still be Nikki Cross, and you wouldn't be dressed up to go trick-or-treating. But I digress. She said her superhero costume gave her confidence, and if you believe in yourself, you can overcome all the odds. It worked for me, and it can work for you. We can all be almost superheroes. That wasn't even the bad part. That came later. Damian Priest pinned Sheamus in a championship contenders match, that's their new favorite phrase, where they beat the champion on TV, and the challenger faces them again, this time for the title. Now, I don't know why you would want to beat your champions on TV, but they have a fetish for it in this company. I want Priest to get a U.S. title match because he did pin the champion, but why give away the match at all? Is there no other way to build up Priest and name a number one contender other than giving us a dry run of their pay-per-view match? I don't like that. But Priest should be the one to take the title from Sheamus. I am all in on building up Damian Priest. AJ Styles and Omos beat the Viking Raiders for a second time in 2 weeks to retain their Raw Tag Team titles. I enjoyed both matches. I cannot wait for the third and the fourth and the fifth. Eventually, they're going to run out of ways for Styles and Omos to win. But later in the show, AJ had a proposition for Miz and Morrison. Morrison was having a match later with Matt Riddle. Styles and Omos stood ringside for the match. Omos snapped Riddle's scooter in half, which distracted him, and Morrison won after hitting Starship Pain. Styles then laid out Riddle with a Styles Clash while the fans chanted for Randy Orton, but he never showed. The fact that they're even having Styles and Omos attack Riddle means they're expecting Randy Orton back very soon. Possibly as soon as tomorrow night. And we are going to be getting RK-Bro getting a title match and hopefully a title win at SummerSlam. Jinder Mahal came out with Veer and a lawyer threatening to sue Drew McIntyre for brutally beating Shanky with a chair the week before. It's always fun when we get wrestlers threatening litigation on TV. WWE, AEW, Impact, they've all done it. It's always so much fun. He wanted Drew to apologize. He wouldn't. He said that he would instead beat Veer to within an inch of his life, and he got the crowd to start a Drew is gonna kill you chant. And Mahal gave Veer a chair late in the match to use. McIntyre Claymore kicked it back into his face for the DQ. Initially, they announced it as a DQ win for Drew, since Mahal is the one who introduced the chair into the match. But then Corey Graves later said, in the record books, it would be a disqualification win for Veer. Tough break for Drew. You know, he spent a year as the champion and fighting for the title, working in front of no fans, only to get fans back in the buildings, and now he's getting disqualified against Veer. You might say that his push has veered off the road. Natty and Tamina got a win over Eva Marie and Doudrop. Two awful things happened in this match. Well, three. First, Eva Marie. That was awful thing number one. Second, Natty got hurt on a pin attempt with Doudrop. Doudrop went to cradle her, and her right leg got bent at a nasty angle. Natty posted a photo on her Twitter of the exact moment that it happened, and a person's leg is not meant to bend at that angle. She couldn't put any weight on it. Apparently it was her ankle, not her knee. She tagged out to Tamina, who wrestled the rest of the match and won. She tweeted a photo on Friday of Tyson Kidd wheeling her through the hospital with her right foot in a walking boot with the caption, "Today my surgeon told me that I am an anomaly. It's been an intense week to say the least. All I asked was to be put back in the fight and fast. Surgery will fix me. Defending our championships will drive me. Hashtag unbreakable." So she had surgery, and that sound that you heard just now was Tamina throwing furniture once she realized the biggest push of her career is probably over. But they'll be making some kind of announcement on Raw tomorrow night about the tag team title situation. The third awful thing from that match on Monday, Eva lost off of the distraction by Alexa Bliss, or I should say, by Lily, We only heard Alexa's voice on the Tron. She didn't actually appear live. But she showed a parody video mocking the Eva Marie comeback vignettes with the doll. In place of Eva, instead of Evolution, it's Lilylution. This allowed Tamina to hit a super kick and score the pin. And that's when she rushed over to Natty to assist her to the back. By the way, she put hashtag unbreakable. She seemed very breakable to me if she had to have surgery. But she's not someone for as long as she's been there, since 2007 Natty has been there, who really has ever been out with a significant injury that I can recall. The Miz was another one, you know, as long as he's been with the company for, even longer than her. Until he hurt his knee in the zombie apocalypse with Damian Priest, you know, he's been on TV rolling around in a wheelchair ever since. I don't recall there being any kind of significant injury that Miz has sustained that's kept him out for any length of time. He's had concussions and stuff like that, but I remember Kofi Kingston gave him a Trouble in Paradise kick on Raw that one time and put a permanent dent in his forehead. But Natty would be on that list of people who, you know, you usually don't hear about injury-wise, but at some point, the injury bug bites everybody. Last week, in his Raw debut, the NXT champion Karrion Kross was pinned in 90 seconds by Jeff Hardy. And Kross told Hardy that he just made the biggest mistake of his life, which would lead you to think that there was a receipt coming for Jeff. But then COVID did what Karrion Kross could not. It beat Jeff Hardy, and it knocked him off the show this week, and very likely tomorrow night as well. Jeff was pulled from a meet and greet after testing positive for COVID-19. So he was pulled from the show. Surprisingly, Kross wrestled on this show, despite being exposed to Jeff, but I guess they thought the risk of exposure was low, I guess. Fightful reported that had Hardy not been pulled from the show, the plan was for him to beat Karrion Kross again for the second straight week. Maybe Kross got wind of their plans and he had Scarlett shoot a COVID blow dart into Jeff's ass when he wasn't looking just to get him off the show. What a heel. What a heel move. If he did, then it worked, because who did they put him in the ring with this time? The other loser from last week's show, Keith Lee, who is back to posting cryptic tweets. Now he's changed his Twitter name to Eventual Lee. Get it? Very clever. He tweeted, "I've decided I am just going to tell you guys the story myself. Give me a week or two." And then he replied to another user who told him, "It's not our business unless you want to tell us." And he responded, "I do. I wanted to do it in a special manner, but instead, I will just have to chat directly." And my whole attitude about the whole thing, honestly, is whatever. Whatever. If he tells us, great. If he doesn't, I really don't give a shit anymore. He lost again. One of them had to lose. At least it wasn't the NXT champion this time. Lee fought out of the Kross jacket, tried for a spirit bomb. Kross escaped, hit a Saito suplex, locked on the Kross jacket for the submission win. Keith Lee taps out. He may be tapping out of WWE soon. That's the vibe that I'm getting from all this. Would not at all be shocking to me if he was on his way out. We had Mansoor and Mustafa Ali. They are a tag team now. They picked up a win over Mace and T-Bar. I actually like Mace and T-Bar as a team. The fact that they kept them together, they just need to start racking up some wins. They can't win. They just keep losing. Mace could be money. He's got something with that look. But with them planning a return to Saudi Arabia later this year, if anyone's going to be racking up wins, it's going to be Mansoor. Ali looked shocked. He almost looked disappointed that they won, like he wasn't expecting it. Andrew Zarian of the Mat Men podcast is reporting that WWE is returning to Saudi Arabia in October. Barring any travel issues, this would be their first Saudi show since Sweet Saudi Money 5, Staying Alive, in February of last year. October 21st looks to be the date for Sweet Saudi Money 6, Turning Tricks with the Saudi Prince. And by then, they'll probably be broken up already, and it'll be Mansoor against Ali. And get this. That Queen of the Ring tournament that I mentioned last week that they're planning, The plan is to hold matches on the October 8th SmackDown and the October 11th Raw, with the finals to be held in Saudi Arabia. I thought I was reading kayfabe news when I saw that. I had to do a double take. Bobby Lashley and MVP were out to respond to Goldberg, who had a canasta game he had to make, so he wasn't there. There was a sign in the crowd that said, "Goldberg is covered by AARP. Lashley said he wouldn't even dignify Goldberg's challenge with a response, even though he already gave one on Twitter. He said, "No thanks." They put tweets up on the screen every week on this show, but I guess they must have missed that one from the WWE champion. It's like you either acknowledge Twitter exists or you don't. Clearly they do, and they just pretended that tweet didn't exist. Cedric Alexander and Shelton Benjamin interrupted to remind us of what a dumb fucking move it was breaking up the Hurt Business. Every bit as stupid now as it was when they did it in the first place. Cedric said Lashley broke them up because he knew Cedric was better than him. Benjamin wasn't there to complain, he said, about the Hurt Business. He was there to give Lashley a real challenge. Lashley said that he would take them both at the same time. He's hardcore. So we had ourselves a 2-on-1 handicap match. Didn't last very long. Ended with Lashley stacking them up on top of each other and pinning them. Roman Reigns did it better. Goldberg is scheduled to be back on the show tomorrow night, barring an unexpected game of bridge. Otherwise, he will be there. In the main event, Charlotte Flair pinned the Raw Women's Champion in one of those championship contenders matches, which didn't make much sense, given that she was already announced for a title match at SummerSlam at the beginning of the show. She wasn't taking Nikki seriously as any kind of real threat. Nikki hit a crossbody like she did the week before to win the title, but this time Charlotte rolled through and pinned her. After the match, Kevin Patrick climbed into the ring to congratulate Charlotte on her win. She was aghast that anybody would even feel the need to congratulate her. She barely broke a sweat. She told Nikki that she wasn't in her league. And Nikki Cross then took the mic and admitted that she lost, but she was almost a superhero. And she showed herself that she almost could have won. Excuse me? You're the fucking champion. You're proud that you almost won? Who writes this shit? It's like I'm watching a fucking after-school special. She said she was confident that she could beat Charlotte next week and challenge her to a rematch, which Charlotte accepted. And then she beat the crap out of the champion to close out the show. Imagine if the 1-2-3 kid had debuted in 93 the way that he did, with a fluke win over Razor Ramon, and then he proceeded to lose every single match to him after that. And he cut promos about how proud he was that he almost beat Razor. And he said this while being the WWE champion. You would say that Vince McMahon was out of his fucking mind. This Nikki Ash stuff is obviously geared to little girls, but there was way too much of it on this show. Keep this shit to a minimum, because this is embarrassing to watch. This should be a little side story, a little inspirational side story on the show, not the main focus the way it was this week. The SmackDown portion of the SummerSlam card has now been solidified coming out of the show on Friday night, which was nothing special outside of the angles to set up those matches. The wrestling on the show was nothing to write home about. John Cena opened the show again, said to Roman Reigns, "Roman has to change every 2 years because you people stop caring about him. And you don't believe in him because Roman Reigns doesn't believe in himself. Roman Reigns is nothing but a lazy stooge named Joe who coasts by on every gimmick in the system and is nothing more than a blood-sucking product of the machine who is so, so afraid to fail. Roman, I would have embarrassed your ass at SummerSlam and you know it. You didn't reject me because of how I look. You're afraid to fight me because of how I'll make you look." So I'm enjoying the back and forth so far between these two. Very Cena Rock-esque from when they had their first match back in 2012. Baron Corbin came out to beg Cena for help. Baron Corbin is still down on his luck. Cena gave him a few bucks. Corbin was appalled. He goes, you're rich. You're a Hollywood superstar. You're giving me dollars here? What is this? You wanted a role in one of his movies. He offered to play Cena's stuntman. Then he called Cena a selfish man and a Hollywood sellout. And Cena ended up dropping him with the attitude adjustment. Rey Mysterio got a win over Jimmy Uso. The Jimmy Uso streak is over. With Dominic doing to Jimmy what Jey Uso had done to Rey and Dom, using his feet as leverage behind the ref's back to help his dad win the match. So this is not official yet, but clearly this is setting up a tag team title match between these two teams at SummerSlam. We had Carmella and Zelina Vega interrupting Bianca Belair, who was in the ring being interviewed, and Zelina Vega is out there challenging the women's champion. She's challenging her to a match when she has yet to win a fucking match since making her return. But they attack. That paved the way for Sasha Banks to make her big return, her first appearance back since WrestleMania. She made the save. She hugged Bianca. She danced with Bianca. Did Bianca's mute or her music, whoever's music it was. This set up a tag team match for later on in the main event. We all knew where this was going. You've got it. You have to see this coming from a mile away. Why else would she be out there being all buddy-buddy to Bianca Belair? It was only a matter of when are they doing the match. Are they doing it tonight or are they doing it next week? No, they did it on Friday night. We had Reginald defending his 24/7 championship against Chad Gable. They have made changes to Reginald's character. He is no longer Reginald the French Sommelier. He is now Reggie from St. Louis, Missouri. He has been a WWE fan his whole life. He saw a posting somewhere that Carmella was looking for a sommelier. He said, I could do that. But she wanted him to speak with a French accent. I haven't been this shocked since Kofi Kingston lost his Jamaican accent. He's also now using the old Sin Cara hidden trampoline for his entrance, bouncing his way into the ring. I said, this is the perfect role for him. He can flip, he can twist, he can keep the comedy belt occupied, like Crash Holly did with the hardcore title. Although not nearly as entertaining. I almost feel bad for even making that comparison, because I actually like Crash Holly with the hardcore title. It was very entertaining. The skits in the different places, they would shoot on location, people chasing after him. It was unique, it was fresh, it was funny. I don't know that I would use those words for any of this stuff. But at least they took it off R-Truth. They're trying it with somebody else, and we'll see. But for Reginald, or Reggie, or whatever the fuck they want us to call him, this is the perfect role for him. Otis attacked him, though, for the disqualification. We had a disqualification in a 24/7 title match. Apparently, normal rules apply to these matches once the bell rings. But it is still very dumb. We had a contract signing for SummerSlam with Finn Balor and Roman Reigns, who got Chance of Cena. And Roman said, we've already seen Mr. Missionary tonight. Reigns told Balor, look, if you sign that contract, I'm going to smash you and send you right back to NXT. And Roman signed the contract. Balor said it would be his privilege to return to NXT. Oh, I'll bet. I'll bet. I'll bet there's a lot of people who feel that way. But it'll be his privilege to return to NXT, he says, once again as the Universal Champion. And right before he could sign on the dotted line, Baron Corbin. Like some homeless guy attacking him in the ring, he attacks Finn Balor, he tosses him over the barricade by the timekeeper's area. Corbin gets back in the ring, he takes the contract, it looks like he's going to sign it himself. Which is apparently, it's the new 24/7 title where just anybody can sign it. John Cena ran down, he posted Corbin shoulder first in the corner. While Roman just sat there at the head of the table watching all of this unfold, and John Cena signed the contract with a giant blue Sharpie in big letters that everybody could see. And later on backstage, Paul Heyman was not happy. He said the contract is non-binding. Adam Pearce said, well, I see Roman's signature and I see Cena's signature, and that's good enough for me. This is the same thing they did for the WrestleMania 20 contract signing, where Shawn Michaels super kicked Chris Benoit and he signed the contract before Benoit could. And it wound up being a triple threat match. Somebody needs to teach these people about contract law. This is not how it works. Unless it specifically says open contract on there, which I don't believe it did. They showed it on camera. I don't believe it said that. Balor looked like a total afterthought here, but he was never going to face Roman Reigns at SummerSlam. I figured at the most, they'll do a TV match, and I'm glad they didn't. I could sit here and say, oh, they made Balor look dumb and everything, but you know what? I'm glad they didn't do the match. They didn't burn it, because Balor should be one of the first people coming out of SummerSlam that Roman is programmed with, if not the first one. You could do a whole program. You can get two or three matches out of it between Roman and Balor. Why blow it off before SummerSlam? Nobody actually expected Roman to lose the belt before SummerSlam anyway. Everybody knew that the end game here was Roman and Cena. It's the only reason Cena came back. But what it did here was it sets him up to be Roman's first challenger coming out of the pay-per-view, which he should have been anyway. But this Friday, he's going to wrestle Baron Corbin. Big E, Cesaro, and Nakamura beat Apollo Crews, Dolph Ziggler, and Bobby Roode when Nakamura pinned Crews. And I saw, according to Sean Ross Sapp, Apollo has now lost 6 matches since becoming the Intercontinental Champion. Champs are chumps. Say it loud, say it proud. I have a t-shirt that says it. Go to Pro Wrestling Tees and buy it. Champs are chumps. I even have one of the side plates on my custom Solomonster belt, in fact, says that very phrase. We saw it with the Raw Women's Champion on Monday. We saw it with the U.S. Champion on Monday. And we saw it with the NXT Champion on Raw the week before that. Champs are chumps in this company, unless your name is Roman Reigns. Edge got jumped by Seth Rollins in an angle that they shot during the commercial break, oddly enough. Edge was on his way out for a promo. They cut the commercial. They came back and showed us a replay of what happened, and Seth had assaulted him, and Rollins in the ring says that if I can't be Universal Champion, then neither can Edge. And he walked to the back. So again, it's not official yet, but obviously that is one of the matches for SummerSlam. And in the main event, Sasha Banks and Bianca Belair beat Carmella and Zelina Vega when Sasha made Carmella tap out to the bank statement. I think the biggest surprise here was not what happened after the match was over. It's the fact that they had Carmella do the job and tap out instead of Zelina to keep her losing streak going. But when the match was over, they're celebrating. Bianca Belair, clearly very green. She's very much still a rookie. She should have seen this coming. She gets dropped with a backstabber. Sasha starts to beat the hell out of her. She puts her in the bank statement. We got the visual tap out by Bianca to end the show. So this was great. We got heel Sasha Banks back. That is Sasha at her best. Heel Sasha, vindictive Sasha, out for revenge, is the best Sasha Banks. She got a lot of cheers too. I mean, she got boos, but she had a fair amount of cheers from the crowd when she held up that belt at the end of the show. It's weird, you know, I don't know if it was just a case of her being off filming stuff for The Mandalorian. We have not seen her. She has had time off ever since WrestleMania. We have not seen her. She has not wrestled a match. I'm guessing it was filming for the show. But she comes back and it just, I think it will be the same thing when Becky Lynch comes back in these next few weeks. But Sasha is one of a select few. She's almost in this rarefied air in this company where she just feels like a big star. She's not just another person. And as well she shouldn't be, because she's a special talent. She, if she's not the best, she's certainly one of the best that they have in the entire company. But it feels to me, especially watching her make her big return on the show and the reaction she got, she really is in that rarefied air of if you just kind of have a select handful of talents, you know, half a dozen or less, you wanted to ball up in the palm of your hand and not let them go, you would have Roman Reigns, right? You can pick out the few people that you would have on there. She would be among those talents. She's crossed over into that realm. And doing the WrestleMania rematch at SummerSlam between them is the biggest possible women's match that they could do. Again, short of Becky coming back and trying to get her belt back and all that. this is the match. This is the biggest match that they could do. The key SmackDown matches for SummerSlam are far more appealing to me than the Raw matches. I mean, look at what we got. We got Roman Reigns against John Cena, right? One of the biggest matches, period, that they could do. We have Sasha and Bianca, the biggest women's match at the moment that they could do. And we have Edge and Rollins. And even though I don't really care for the Rollins character, you know, in the ring, the guy could go. I can't imagine he and Edge go out there and stink out the joint. I'm sure they're going to have a very good, if not great, match. And you figure the Usos are going to end up defending the tag team titles against Rey and Dominic. So you look at the SmackDown side of that SummerSlam card so far, it is leaps and bounds better than what we're looking at right now on Monday Night Raw, which is Lashley and Goldberg. Right? The quicker that ends, the better, probably. Whatever the fuck they're doing with the Raw women's title, which I am absolutely not digging at all right now. I don't care for any of it. And what else do you have after that? What's the other big attraction on the Monday Night Raw side? I guess maybe Orton and Riddle, probably, going for the Raw tag team titles against AJ and Omos. That would probably be it. You know, Sheamus and Damian Priest will make for a nice match on the undercard. That's hardly some big attraction on the show. So right now, SmackDown is just kicking Raw's ass, heading into SummerSlam. It is official. Samoa Joe is getting back into the ring for the first time in 18 months, and he will be challenging Karrion Kross for the NXT Championship at TakeOver 36, SummerSlam weekend, which looks to be taking place at the COVID Coliseum in Orlando. And if so, that is a massive disappointment. Atmosphere is everything for these takeovers, and the Performance Center has wore out its welcome for those shows. But now that we know that Joe is cleared to wrestle again, it makes the company's decision to fire him back in April even more baffling. If he was that close to being medically cleared to perform again, why the fuck would you fire someone like Samoa Joe? I mean, that was a dumb move back then. It's even dumber now. They're lucky to have somebody like Triple H, who had enough common sense in his head to pick up the phone right away and get him back, because can you imagine Tony Khan pulling off the hat trick of Punk, Brian, and Joe coming into AEW all at once? You know, people were joking about Punk and Brian coming in. Who's the third man? You know, comparing it to the NWO. There's your third man. And it could have happened, were it not for some quick thinking by the cerebral assassin over here. Pete Dunne and Oney Lorcan defeated Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher. Ridge Holland, after a 10-month absence with those horrific leg injuries that I mentioned last week, showed up at ringside. He took down Thatcher. While in the ring, Dunne finished off Ciampa with the bitter end. When we last saw Holland, he was Pat McAfee's hired gun. And McAfee was leading a group of Dunne, Lorcan, and Danny Burch, who's out with his own injury still. So now it's Dunne leading the charge, and it looks like it looks to me like they're protecting him for an eventual match with Samoa Joe. They've been teasing it on TV. The two of them haven't spoken. He and Joe, two or three different times, have bumped into each other. They've mean mugged. They've stared at each other. And then they usually just cut away. So they have planted little teases here and there for a future match between Joe and Dunne. I think they're protecting Pete Dunne for that eventual, probably title match against Samoa Joe. The way I see it, Joe wins the championship from Karrion Kross. The quicker they get the belt off him, the better off it's going to be for the belt. And then he defends against Pete Dunne as his first challenger before eventually dropping the title to Walter. That sounds like a damn good plan to me. Feel free to take it. It's all yours. Samoa Joe stormed to the ring with a contract in hand. He pulled out a table from under the ring. He pulled out a chair. He threw both of them into the ring and set them up. He looked like the world's angriest busboy who got called to work the early shift on his day off, and he had to set up before the restaurant opens. He invited William Regal to come to the ring, and he said, "I know you're going to fire Karrion Kross. Should have fired him for losing to Jeff Hardy. That should have been the first thing that Regal did, was come out the very next night and say, hand over the belt, you're done. You've shamed us." He said, "I know you're going to fire Karrion Kross. I've got a much better idea. It's a three-step process. Step one, he handed Regal his resignation letter for his role as the NXT enforcer. Step two, he presented a different piece of paper, a contract for Regal to sign that makes him an active part of the NXT talent roster. Regal never said a word because he doesn't have to. He let his facial expressions do the talking for him. And he signed the paper. And finally, step three was a contract for a title match against Cross at TakeOver 36, which Regal also signed. This was the best damn contract signing this company has ever done. Joe's intensity, it's always off the charts. And they kept the talking to a minimum. The fans were elated to see him back in the ring. And NXT now has itself a hell of a main event for their next big show. But there is still time to get it into a bigger building, even back in Full Sail. I would take that over the Performance Center. They can make it a homecoming. That's what AEW is doing this Wednesday. They're going back to Daly's place. I have no idea. Well, actually, I think they were trying to book another building and they ran out of time, so that's why they're going back there and whatever. But they're calling it their homecoming. NXT has not been inside Full Sail, the little arena there, in a very long time, at least probably 18 months, probably by now. I would take that. I don't know what the COVID guidelines are on campus at Full Sail, if they would allow a gathering of 500 people, but if they can make that happen, then they should absolutely do it. If they're not going to go to Vegas, that's the next best thing. Throughout the show, they cut to a series of comedy skits on a golf course, somewhere with a combination here, the Abbott and Costello of NXT, L.A. Knight and Cameron Grimes. Knight made Grimes his caddy. Well, first he made him his butler, but this week he made him his caddy. Grimes was washing his balls, Knight's balls, his golf balls, I should clarify. Grimes was annoying him by wanting to place expensive bets on whether Knight would be able to make his shots. One of his balls landed in the lake. He told Grimes to go fetch it out of the water, which he did. And that's when Ted DiBiase rolled up in a golf cart. Apparently, he plays on the same course. And he asked Grimes, "What the hell are you doing in the water?" And Grimes said, "Oh, I'm fetching the ball for Mr. Knight, because I'm a man of my word." And DiBiase told him that he needs to stick up for himself and fight for what he believes in. This was like a scene at the end of a Full House episode where one of the uncles teaches a life lesson to the children. The only thing missing was the dramatic music in the background. But in the final segment, we had the grizzled young veterans. They showed up in their own golf cart. Well, what is this? Is this an all-wrestlers golf course? I was waiting for the hole-in-one cameo from Barry Darso. They were annoyed that Grimes and Knight were taking too much time between holes. It ended with Grimes going to take a swing. He was going to take a shot. And he accidentally hit L.A. Knight in the crotch with his club when he reared back. And then when, on the follow-through, after he took his shot, he struck Knight right in the head. But he sank the ball right in the hole. He had no idea that he even hit him. Nor did Knight know who hit him. So he ran after the grizzled young vets, figuring it was them. They drove off. I enjoyed these. It was stupid, campy comedy, but I enjoyed the interaction and the chemistry between these two. Knight and Grimes, you know, they play off of each other so well. It's almost too bad they have to wrestle each other, because I think they would make a great odd couple tag team. They got a little Rockin' Mankind in them. That's what they remind me of, Rockin' Mankind. Carmelo Hayes topped Josh Briggs in their opening round match in the breakout tournament, the best of the three matches we've seen so far. Briggs just towered over him. Duke Hudson sat in on commentary for the match. He meets Hayes in the semifinals. Hudson and Odyssey Jones are the other two names that have advanced so far. Hayes was my pick to win the whole thing. He still is. But I kind of figured that it was between him and Duke Hudson. So whoever wins that match, I think, is going to be your tournament winner. We finally had the big split between Dakota Kai and Raquel Gonzalez. Raquel was out there to address the NXT audience, and she was wondering who will be next to challenge her for her championship. And Dakota talked about how my best friend is the most dominant woman in NXT history, and she was really putting her over being better than Charlotte and Sasha and Asuka and all the big names that came before her in NXT. And she looked at the entranceway and she said, is there any woman tough enough to come out and challenge Raquel for the championship? And nobody came out. And Dakota said that as long as I'm in your corner, you will always be champion. And she raised Raquel's hand and Raquel's music played. They wanted you to think the segment was over. And as Gonzalez was posing on the rope, she stepped down, she turned around, and she ate a kick right in the face from Dakota Kai. And she fell to the mat, and Dakota grabbed the belt and looked down at her and was talking some smack to her. So this is two similar angles they've now done in the same week between this and Sasha turning on Bianca on SmackDown. I thought this was okay. I mean, there's any number of ways you could have done the split. This is not the way that I would have done it. I think you could have even done it in a tag team match, you know, which maybe is like a more traditional way of doing it. But they chose to do it this way. It just always looks goofy to me when you do that where, hey, listen, anybody who walks out, you'll be the next contender for the women's title. Come on down. And then nobody comes down. They have such a robust women's division in this company. They have a lot of great women in that division down there in NXT. Just the idea that Dakota Kai would stand there and say, anybody who wants to come out next and challenge Raquel Gonzalez, come on down. You're the next contestant. And nobody would come out, to me, is very goofy. But I wish they would have flipped it with Dakota just straight up asking for a title match and then building it up as a match between two friends for the championship. Then you can have Raquel win at TakeOver. Then you have the option of either having Dakota go heel out of frustration and building to a rematch with Raquel as the babyface. Or after Raquel beats her, she just becomes totally full of herself and she drops Dakota as dead weight. But Dakota knows that she can beat her. You have her fight to earn another match. And now you have this great underdog story with Dakota Kai getting one last shot to win the NXT Women's Championship that she has never held. The way they did this, it was predictable, but you know, my bigger issue is the size disparity between them. She just towers over Dakota. So it works better, I think, if Kai works as the underdog babyface. We had a segment where Io Shirai was shown earlier in the day in a ring training alone at the PC, and Zoe Stark, her partner, approached her and said, hey, you know, we should train together. After all, we are the NXT Women's Tag Team Champions. Oh, by the way, not a bad suggestion. And Io said, Io basically blew her off because she didn't like her. And Zoe is like, we could form a relationship here. And Io goes, friends? And she says, yeah, friends. And she goes, no thanks. So I don't know. It's weird to me. Did I miss something here? Have they teased before that Io does not like Zoe Stark? Maybe there was a YouTube segment I missed. She did not seem to have any issues with her up to this point. So this just felt to me like it came out of left field. Although I did like Io's attitude of friends? Fuck that. I don't need any friends. Fucking right. Io Shirai don't need no friends. We had Casey Catanzaro and Caden Carter, that's a lot of K's, beating Frankie Monet, or Moquet, and Jesse Kamea. I'm trying to get all the K's lined up here. Catanzaro got the win. She pinned Frankie Monet. Monet was working over Carter when Robert Stone got up on the apron. He offered his little man purse to Monet to use as a weapon, even though she was in control at the time. That was enough of a distraction, though. It backfired. It led to Carter and Catanzaro hitting their neckbreaker 450 combo. Catanzaro pinned Monet to win the match. That is the first time that Frankie Monet has eaten defeat since coming to NXT. It was a very odd way for her to lose in her first match. But the story is that she was upset with Robert Stone for costing her the win. My question is, did she really need to be the one to eat the pin when you've got Jesse Kamea standing there on the apron? I don't think so. Wade Barrett had a sit-down interview earlier with Roderick Strong and Malcolm Bivens of the Diamond Mine faction. And Roddy talked about how after he left Undisputed Era, he couldn't break through the mental trauma. He said he ran into Malcolm Bivens, who reminded him of who he really is. And Bivens said that Roddy is a number one of his generation. He talked about pulling Strong out of retirement from NXT. And Wade says he sees Roddy going after Kushida's Cruiserweight Championship and said he also sees the next big match being between former Undisputed Era members Roderick Strong and Bobby Fish. And Malcolm Bivens said that Fish and Strong is a big money match. I can't even say that in the recap with a straight face. He said that's a big money match, maybe Monopoly money. Strong said that when he finishes Fish, this is over. So finally, we got to hear some more from Malcolm Bivens, and this segment only reiterated what I have been saying before, which is that Roderick Strong is about as charismatic as a burnt piece of toast. So they should allow Malcolm Bivens to do more of the talking going forward. William Regal, Paul Levesque, and Shawn Michaels were in a segment that they inserted into the show. They're all standing together in the back to make the announcement that the postponed NXT UK title match between Walter and Ilya Dragunov will now take place at TakeOver 36. I mentioned that last week. That only enhances the TakeOver card that much more. In fact, that instantly becomes neck and neck with the Samoa Joe match for me is the match that I am most looking forward to. We had Hit Row, Top Dollar, and Ashanti the Adonis representing Hit Row. They took the loss against Imperium, Fabian Aichner, and Marcel Bartel. After a run-in by Legado del Fantasma, they turned up the heat on this feud between the two factions this week. And Adam Cole pinned Bronson Reed in the main event clean in the middle with the last shot, right to the back of the head. I kind of look at that as being something of a metaphor, as Bronson Reed now prepares to venture to the main roster. You may as well take him out back and put a slug right in the back of his fucking head. This felt like his swan song here on NXT. May the wrestling gods have mercy on his soul as he soon journeys to Raw or SmackDown. I feel like he would fare better on SmackDown than he would on Raw. But after the match, Kyle O'Reilly attacked Adam Cole. He choked him with a chair, and then he delivered a brainbuster on the flat surface of the ring steps. That is how the show ended, as they built to the third and final match at TakeOver between these two men. This Tuesday, it is a taped show again on Sci-Fi with Roderick Strong against Bobby Fish. John Wayne Gacy, or Joe Gacy. Joe Gacy against Trey Baxter in a first-round match in the breakout tournament. Hit Row against Legado del Fantasma. And Johnny Gargano takes on Dexter Lumis in a Love Her or Lose Her match, where if Dexter wins, he and Indy Hartwell can be together. The Love Her or Leave Her match at SummerSlam in 99 between Test and Shane McMahon is still one of my favorites to this day. It's a match that I was not expecting to be as enjoyable as it was. Hopefully this one can be half as enjoyable as that one. Hey, the heart wants what the heart wants. Nothing can stop love. Except a restraining order. But that was just a misunderstanding.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, we begin 49 years ago this week on August 1st, 1972. Wrestler and promoter Ray Gunkel was wrestling Ox Baker in Savannah, Georgia. And what a great name, by the way, Ox Baker. I just watched Ox on an old episode of The Price is Right. Seemed like a lovely man. But on this night, he was not so lovely. The two men squared off in a taped fist match that Gunkel won, but when he got back to the dressing room, he collapsed. A hematoma had formed as a result of Baker either chopping him in the chest or hitting him with a heart punch. I've seen both mentioned, and the hematoma had swollen to the size of a gumball. When it suddenly broke off, it formed a blood clot that traveled to his heart, and it led to a fatal heart attack at the age of 48. Baker told a different story to the Orlando Sentinel in the year 2000. He claimed that Gunkel, who had a history of high blood pressure, had gone to an all-you-can-eat buffet before the show. He had 12 pieces of fried chicken, and his heart burst when he went to try to lift Baker up. And an autopsy revealed that Gunkel did have heart disease, but said it played no direct role in his death. The coroner said Gunkel suffered an accidental death due to injury to his heart during the match. I do like the story, though, that he ate fried chicken and his heart exploded. This was not the only death that Ox Baker was tied to. 1 year earlier, there was Alberto Torres, who died at the young age of 37. After participating in a tag team match against Baker, he suffered a ruptured pancreas and he died 3 days later. So promoters started booking Baker and labeling him as a killer as a way to sell more tickets. After the match with Gunkel, he took the heart punch as a move to play off of what had happened. 39 years ago this week, on July 28, 1982, months after their match in Memphis at the Mid-South Coliseum, where Jerry Lawler gave Andy Kaufman not one, but two pile drivers and sent him to the hospital, came their famous confrontation on The Late Show with David Letterman. Lawler has said that Kaufman was the best thing that ever happened to his wrestling career. It got him national exposure. Andy was a huge wrestling fan. He was obsessed with wrestling. He even pitched the idea to Vince McMahon Sr. backstage once in Madison Square Garden the year before about coming in to do something with the WWF. But McMahon wasn't interested in mixing wrestling with Hollywood. He just didn't want to do that. That was the same night that Kaufman rode the train with Bill Apter back to Bill's apartment, and Apter picked up the phone and called Jerry Lawler. It was midnight, and Lawler was up, and he answered the phone, and he called Lawler to tell him, hey, guess who I've got with me in my apartment? I've got Andy Kaufman. And the rest is history. So after taking the two pile drivers, Andy sold it like his neck was broken. He stayed in the hospital in traction for 3 days to sell it, even though there was nothing physically wrong with him. And then he spent the next 5 months wearing a neck brace. Fast forward to July 28th. Lawler and Kaufman, they were booked on Letterman's TV show to supposedly bury the hatchet and put their differences aside. They were flown to New York, and according to Lawler in his book, they both met with Letterman's producer to go over the segment. The producer wanted Lawler to be a little bit adversarial, you know, maybe argue back and forth a little bit. Then they would go to break, and they would come back, and Andy would apologize for making fun of wrestling. Lawler would apologize for hurting his neck. And then Andy would get up, and he would sing, "What the world needs is love, sweet love." So they get back to the hotel, and Andy calls Lawler. He goes, "So what do you think of what they want us to do?" And Lawler says, "Well, it should be funny, but it's pretty much going to be the end of our program. This is going to be the end of the whole deal with you and me." And Kaufman says, "Yeah, I know. I don't really like that. I wish there was something else that we could do." He says, "What if I refused your apology and you just slugged me?" And Lawler said, "Well, since the show is taped, A, they probably wouldn't air it, and B, they would have me arrested." And Andy goes, yeah, you're probably right. But man, wouldn't that be great? Well, Andy, yeah, would certainly keep our stuff alive. That's what Lawler told him. So then he tells Lawler, "Just think about it." And he hangs up the phone. And the two of them didn't speak to each other or see each other again until they were on stage for the show. Lawler said what happened was pretty much ad-libbed. He didn't know what Andy was going to do. Andy didn't know what he was going to do. Things got out of hand verbally between the two of them. And Lawler could hear the music that they were playing in the background, because they were playing them to a commercial break. And Lawler knew, once he heard that music come on, he knew, or it was right before the music, but he could tell they were about to cut to a break. And he knew, if I don't do anything now, then that's it. So if I'm going to do something, I better haul off and knock this guy into the middle of next week now before it's too late. And he stood up and he slapped the shit out of him. He hit him so hard, he knocked Andy right out of his chair. And when they came back from commercial, Andy just launched into this profanity-laced tirade, threatening to sue Lawler, calling him a fucking asshole over and over again. And I love the part, he's just pacing back and forth, and Letterman is just sitting there, just clearly not knowing, you know, okay, where is this going here? How far is he going to take this? And he comes back over, he goes, "I'm sorry." He goes, "I'm sorry to use these words on television, but you're a fucking asshole." And he starts cursing again. And he grabbed, I think it was either water or coffee that was sitting on Dave's desk, and he splashed it in Lawler's face, and then he ran off. But the story made national headlines, including in the New York Times. And Lawler claims that Letterman was not smartened up about anything that they did. Letterman, though, in an interview on Mark Maron's podcast a couple of years ago, claimed that Andy did clue him in about what he was going to do with the slap. I mean, I don't know if he told him about the cussing afterwards, but he did tell him, hey, look, I'm going to, you know, we're going to work this thing and he's going to smack me. And he was saying, you know, every time he would have Kaufman on the show, he says Andy was very good about cluing him in, you know, in advance about what he was going to do. It didn't sound to me like he was just kind of saying that to save face. It's possible that Andy did tell Letterman and Andy didn't tell Lawler that he was going to tell Letterman, but you kind of get two conflicting stories there between Lawler and Letterman. But whoever is telling the truth, it made for great television. And it got Jerry Lawler more mainstream publicity than he had ever gotten, and probably since, in his entire life. 36 years ago this week, on July 30th, 1985, at the WWF Championship Wrestling taping at the Mid-Hudson Civic Center in Poughkeepsie, New York, I can still hear Howard Finkel doing the voiceovers on TV telling us that tickets were available. For weeks on television, all of the heel managers in WWE were courting Randy Savage to offer their services. So Bobby Heenan was there, Jimmy Hart, Mr. Fuji, Classy Freddie Blassie. They were all hoping to become the manager of the Macho Man. But Savage had another name in mind. He thanked them all for their interest before introducing his new manager, making her debut, the first lady of wrestling and my first wrestling crush, Miss Elizabeth, who was Savage's real-life wife. I think they had just been married the year before. The gig almost went to Missy Hyatt, who was recommended by WWF booker George Scott at the time, but Savage had suggested his wife to Vince McMahon for the role, telling him, look, she's not tall, she's not blonde, but she's really pretty. So, by the way, for anybody doubting, because I joke from time to time on the podcast about Vince McMahon's infatuation with blondes over the years, I love how Savage had to preface this to him. What is this going back 36 years by saying she's not blonde, but he said that she is very pretty. And when they flew her to Stanford the first time and everybody laid eyes on her and Vince McMahon laid eyes on her, everybody fell in love with her. I mean, how could you not? But can you imagine a young Missy Hyatt as Savage's manager? What a pairing that would have been. 35 years ago this week, on July 26, 1986, on the penultimate night, I love that word, of the Great American Bash Tour in Greensboro, Dusty Rhodes defeated Ric Flair in a steel cage match to win his third and final NWA World Championship. Crockett Promotions took the Bash concept from 1 year before and expanded it in 86 to a month-long tour with Flair, who had been champion for almost 800 days, defending the title each night on every single one of those shows. He defended against names like Magnum T.A., Road Warrior Hawk, Road Warrior Animal, Ricky Morton, Robert Gibson, Nikita Koloff, and others, including Dusty. And after he lost the title, he challenged Dusty for the belt on the final Bash show on August 2nd, but then 1 week later, at a live event in St. Louis, Flair beat Rhodes to win the belt back, ending Dusty's final run with the belt at just 2 weeks. Dusty didn't need the belt to stay over. He only needed it to pay off the chase. The real money was in people chasing Flair for the big gold belt, which he held for another 400 plus days after that. 33 years ago this week, on July 31st, 1988, WWE presented its WrestleFest show outdoors at the Milwaukee County Stadium, then the home of the Milwaukee Brewers, before 25,000 fans. I am sure this had absolutely nothing at all to do with the Crockett show that was running the very next night in the same city at the smaller Mecca Arena with a War Games main event, which had a much smaller crowd too, at just 3,800 people. But I'm sure one had nothing to do with the other. They booked 15 matches on this show, some of which aired on Primetime Wrestling, most of which were eventually released on Coliseum Home Video, so it wasn't even some kind of big pay-per-view or television event. Randy Savage retained his WWE Championship over Ted DiBiase. Hulk Hogan beat Andre the Giant in a steel cage match, an outdoor steel cage match. It was a very unique setting. I will say that. It was a very unique view when you go back and watch that match. And I think it used to be on the network. As I'm recording this, I can't find it on Peacock, so obviously it's not on there. But you can probably surf around and find the match somewhere. Demolition beat the British Bulldogs. And the Ultimate Warrior beat Bobby Heenan in a weasel suit match. And poor Bobby had to go around the loop. He had to go around the horn, working weasel suit matches every night against the Warrior. No wonder he hated him so much. The final time Hogan and Andre shared a ring together would also be in Milwaukee, but not on this night. It was a matinee show on March 24th, 1990, about a week before WrestleMania 6. 25 years ago this week, on the July 29, 1996 edition of WCW Monday Nitro from the Disney MGM Studios in Orlando, a big night for the NWO, as it was the very first night one of their paid announcement vignettes aired on TV. But it also was the night that Rey Mysterio got lawn darted into the side of a trailer by Kevin Nash. During a match with Sting, Lex Luger, and Randy Savage, against the Horsemen, Ric Flair, Chris Benoit, and Steve Mongo McMichael, Jimmy Hart suddenly ran out in a panic. He's grabbing one of the cameramen. He's yelling, "The outsiders are in the back. The outsiders are here." He's trying to get everybody's attention in the ring about this invasion that's going on. And he gets all the babyfaces and all the heels to stop fighting and to run to the back, where we find Scott Hall and Kevin Nash standing over Marcus Bagwell and Arn Anderson with baseball bats in their hands. And all of a sudden, there's a trailer there. Rey Mysterio pops out of the trailer and he climbs up onto the banister. He dives off right into the arms of Kevin Nash. I don't know what Rey thought he was doing, but he got caught by Kevin Nash, who proceeded to lawn dart him headfirst right into the side of the trailer. And once Hall and Nash turn and they see the cavalry is coming, they hightail it into their limousine to go drive off. Randy Savage jumps on top of the limo. He's reaching inside the sunroof as they drive off. Eddie Guerrero is over checking on Rey. The Horsemen are checking on Arn. Everybody is losing their minds. They're really selling this very well. Elizabeth is crying. People were seemingly breaking character. It felt real. It felt authentic. And chaotic. Even little details, like when the medics arrived, and I've heard Eric Bischoff talk about this, when the medics arrived and they pulled off Ray's mask, you know, obviously he covered his face up with his hands, but his mask had never been removed like that on TV before. But that's the sort of thing that you would do if you were treating a real injury, a real head injury. The live crowd in the arena couldn't see any of this, and they started chanting "boring," but for us on TV, it was anything but. It was such a chaotic scene that some of the local residents called 911. They actually called the cops to tell them that there was some kind of a gang war taking place at MGM Studios. Yeah, Mickey got tired of Donald Duck's shit. He decided to throw down, I guess. 2 days later, on July 31st, 1996, at the Summer Olympics in Atlanta, Kurt Angle won a gold medal for the United States in freestyle wrestling with a broken freaking neck, beating the Iranian Abbas Jadidi on a judge's decision. They were tied heading into what ended up being a judge's decision in Angle's favor. It was a tough year for Kurt, not long after he started training with his coach Dave Schultz at his Foxcatcher camp in January. Schultz was gunned down and murdered by John DuPont, who was their sponsor. And later on, during the Olympic trials semifinals, where he punched his ticket to the games, basically, Kurt broke his neck for the first time. He fractured two of his cervical vertebrae, herniated two discs, and he pulled four muscles. And yeah, he may have taken a little bit of time off, but not much, because he was headed to the Olympics. And he did what he had to do to compete. So long before Perk Angle, we had Novocaine Angle, because he would have Novocaine injected directly into his neck to help alleviate the pain so that he could wrestle. Never got his neck fixed the way that he should have, never let it heal the way that he should have. And the one unfortunate thing about that, I mean, he got a gold medal out of it, which, you know, basically was his, that was his biggest accomplishment of his entire life. So I'm sure if you asked him, he wouldn't do anything any differently in that regard. But those neck problems really plagued him for the rest of his career. And even now in retirement, I'm sure his whole body probably doesn't feel too good, but his neck was never the same after that. 23 years ago this week, on July 26, 1998, Fully Loaded aired on pay-per-view from Fresno, California, featuring a dungeon match for the first time ever, with Owen Hart defeating Ken Shamrock with Dan the Beast Severn as the special referee. This was a match taped days in advance from the famous Hart Family Dungeon in Calgary. The Rock and Triple H, they went to a 30-minute time limit draw in a best out of three falls match for the Intercontinental Championship, which I remember being a very good match. Actually, that and their ladder match at SummerSlam back-to-back months turned out to be very good matches. Sable defeated Jacqueline, very famous moment in WWE history. She beat Jacqueline in a bikini contest, but the decision was reversed the next night on Raw because Sable was not exactly wearing a bikini. This is where she wore the handprints on her breasts and Jerry Lawler basically lost his fucking mind, as I'm sure a lot of the young men watching at the time probably did as well and became big Sable fans overnight. And The Undertaker, tagging with Stone Cold Steve Austin, won the tag team championships from Kane and Mankind. The following night, on July 27th, live on Monday Night Raw, Stone Cold Steve Austin debuted the Smoking Skull Championship belt. As the story goes, one night on TV, I don't know if he gave somebody a stunner or what happened, but the Big Eagle belt that Austin had been carrying around on TV, it cut him on the chin. And he was looking to, you know, possibly have a new belt made anyway, because he credits the Road Warriors with giving him the idea, you know, hey, you're Stone Cold, you should have your own custom championship. And Road Warrior Hawk, I think more so than Animal, is the one that he credits with giving him the idea. So he ends up speaking, Austin does, with Joe Marshall. You might know him as J-Mar. And he has him create this custom championship for him. There were two versions made, one gold and one silver. Austin kept the silver one for himself, and he used the gold one on TV without even telling Vince McMahon about it this first night here that he brought it out on Raw. And Vince McMahon was not happy. He told him to stop using it, and he wanted him to revert back to the Big Eagle. But they got so many fan requests and feedback on the Smoking Skull belt that they brought it back. Also on this show, Brakus wrestled his final televised match for WWE, beating Jesus Castillo of Los Boricuas in under a minute, never to be seen again. I don't even have any recollection of Brakus having one match, let alone multiple matches on TV. I remember the vignettes, but yes, Brakus did not last very long. WWE also taped the premiere episode this night of Sunday Night Heat from Anaheim, airing 5 days later. Originally, this was only intended to run for about 6 weeks in the build-up to the Highway to Hell SummerSlam that year. But the show proved to be so successful and so popular that USA kept it on the air. And typically on pay-per-view nights, Heat would be kind of what now would be the kickoff show. Heat would end up serving as the pre-show. Heat was on fire, you know, pun intended, for a while there. There was an episode in March of 99, a regular episode of Heat that did a 5.1 Nielsen rating for Heat. It did a 5.1. But the highest rated episode was the halftime Heat special that year. That popped a 6.6 for the Rock versus Mankind empty arena match. But this episode, this first episode, was also Shane McMahon's debut on television outside of his brief appearances in the early 90s, maybe late 80s. As referee Shane Stevens. You can even see him as one of the referees trying to hold back Miss Elizabeth as she walks down to the ring in the middle of the Randy Savage-Ric Flair match at WrestleMania 8. There's Shane. 21 years ago this week, on July 30th, 2000, iGeneration Superstars of Wrestling taped its one and only pay-per-view event called Rodman Down Under, one of the worst shows of all time, from the Superdome in Sydney, before a crowd of 10,000. How many of those actually paid to get into the building, I don't know, but supposedly there was around 10,000 people in the building. I would say 10,000 unlucky spectators in the crowd that night. Superstars of Wrestling, it was this group that formed, and they held a series of shows in Australia that year featuring various wrestling legends and the legend himself, Dennis Rodman, who they signed to a deal. Per the Observer write-up at the time, Rodman was flown to Australia a week early to do publicity, but partied so much on his first night that he missed all of his scheduled media appearances. Which sounds about right. 2 days before this pay-per-view, Rodman no-showed the autograph session at the show that night, but he did do, kind of did, the planned run-in for him, which was to set up his match on the 30th against Kurt Hennig. And so the planned finish here, we're talking 2 days earlier now, the planned finish of the match between Kurt Hennig and Brutus Beefcake to determine the first ever Superstars of Wrestling World Champion, the plan was for Rodman to come out about midway through the match and attack Hennig, which would lead to a pull apart, and that would build up their match after Hennig would later go on to win the title. Rodman, not surprisingly, arrived late, but he at least showed up in time to run out when the match was already over. But Hennig and Rodman actually had what was said to be the best match on the show in Sydney on this night, ending with what was described as a very lame finish when both men punched the referee after just 5 minutes. Hennig played the heel, fans booed the hell out of Rodman, and the guys did a double turn. Bret Hart and Steve Austin, this was not. Other matches on the card, the Road Warriors beat Public Enemy in an elimination tables match to win the iGeneration Tag Team Championship. Public Enemy would win the belts back just 4 days later. The Barbarian defeated Brute Force, which was Brutus the Barber Beefcake, in a hardcore match. Sweet Destiny beat Brandywine. One Man Gang defeated Tatanka to win the iGeneration Australian Championship after Tatanka had won the title 2 days earlier. And in the main event, Kurt Hennig defeated Dennis Rodman by disqualification in an Australian Outback match to retain the iGeneration World Heavyweight Championship that he had won from Beefcake 2 days prior. Hennig would lose the belt to the Barbarian 3 days later, who would hold the belt for all of 1 day before dropping it back to Kurt, and he would be the last holder of that title. This show would not air in the United States until December. And by that point, the promotion had been disbanded. 19 years ago this week, on July 27th, 2002, at Ring of Honor's Crowning a Champion event at the Murphy Rec Center in Philadelphia, Low-Key defeated Spanky, Christopher Daniels, and Doug Williams in a four-way 60-minute Ironman match to become the first ever Ring of Honor World Champion, a reign that would last a total of 56 days. 17 years ago this week, on July 26, 2004, Monday Night Raw from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, featured only two matches. Chris Benoit defeated Triple H, 4-3, in a 60-minute Ironman match to retain the World Heavyweight Championship. Benoit was down 3-1. He tied the match at about 48 minutes with the crossface and then won it with a pinfall over Triple H following a rock bottom by Eugene with just 6 seconds remaining in the match. I believe this was the last 60-minute Ironman match that WWE aired on free television because the angle Lesnar won on SmackDown came the year before this. And I know they did some other Iron Man matches on pay-per-view, like with Cena and Orton, but that wasn't on free TV. So I think this was the last 60-minute one on free television until last year's four-way Iron Man match on NXT with Adam Cole, Finn Balor, Johnny Gargano, and Tommaso Ciampa, which ended in a damn draw. But the only other match on this show was Randy Orton winning a 20-man battle royal for a World Heavyweight Championship match at SummerSlam. 15 years ago this week, On August 1st, 2006, ECW on Sci-Fi aired live from the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City, the last time WWE ran that venue, which is a great venue. I always loved being inside Hammerstein, although I was not at this show, but I always had fun, especially at all the Ring of Honor shows I was at in that building. So I wish they would go back there for shows, but you can see why. They may have soured on the Hammerstein experience based on what happened here on this night. CM Punk made his WWE in-ring debut with a submission win over Justin Credible. But the reason this show is most remembered for is the main event between Big Show and Batista. Because nothing screams ECW like Batista and the Big Show wrestling for the ECW World Championship. Both men got booed throughout the entire match. There were very vocal chants of boring, same old shit, and change the channel. It ended with a DQ win for Batista. It would be WWE's, and by the way, nothing screams disqualification more than ECW, apparently. But it would be WWE's final appearance, as I mentioned, in the Hammerstein, but you can't really blame the fans for this one, because it was only a few months later that ECW December to Dismember took place on pay-per-view, and that show was a colossal failure. It did so poorly that it led to a planned third one-night stand show at the Hammerstein in 2007 being canceled. 13 years ago this week, on July 28th, 2008, the first Monday Night Raw of the PG era aired after the shift from TV-14 to TV-PG was announced the Tuesday before. Also on this show, announcer Mike Adamly was announced by Shane McMahon as the new general manager of Raw in a very awkward moment before Adamly then announced that Batista would wrestle John Cena at SummerSlam. WWE recognized that Adamly's run as an announcer was just a fucking failure, and this was their way of trying to justify his reported $300,000 a year salary. That's what they were paying him on his contract per year, $300,000, for really working part-time. They had to do something with him to try to justify that kind of contract, and it did not work. And just 3 months later, Adamly was gone. You know, originally they brought Adamly into the company, and I remember when he was hired, I was actually kind of excited because I knew Mike Adamly not really from his football days, but I knew him as the host of American Gladiators. It was him and Larry Zonka, and I used to watch American Gladiators usually after Superstars would air. Locally here in New York on Channel 5 is where I used to watch it every Saturday. Very, very faithfully, I would watch American Gladiators. So that's how I knew him, and I thought, man, that's a great pickup. I mean, I know it's been a while, but this is great. And then they brought him in, and it wasn't so great. But they brought him into the company and made him the lead announcer on ECW with the idea that he would learn on the job, and he would eventually replace Jim Ross. He was brought in as Jim Ross's replacement. Think about that. But 4 years ago, he was diagnosed with dementia and CTE, which might help explain a lot of his flubs on TV and kind of makes it a little less humorous in hindsight, if that had anything to do with it. 8 years ago this week, on the August 1st, 2013 Impact Wrestling episode from Wichita Falls, Texas, Tito Ortiz made his return to TNA as the infamous August 1st Warning in front of a crowd that did not give a shit. But credit to Impact, though. It is rare to get a reverse pop. I've heard of big pops. I've heard of Stone Cold pops, Road Warrior pops. It's very rare that you see a reverse pop, which is what this got. But they managed to pull it off here on this show. Ortiz had appeared, I said return, because he had appeared in TNA previously in 2005 as a referee for a pair of NWA World Title matches. On pay-per-view, he ref the Jeff Jarrett AJ Styles match at Hard Justice and the Jeff Jarrett Rhino match at Bound for Glory. So this was technically his return. But the whole hashtag August 1st Warning thing as they called it. I mean, this was promoted very heavily on their programming and social media for weeks in advance, hyping up some kind of big surprise, some kind of mystery man. And Ortiz walks out, right? This music starts playing. Actually, the lights went out first, but then this music starts playing. And you've got the main event mafia out there, and aces and eights are out there. But then, you know, we see Tito Ortiz walk out. And he's just standing on the ramp with his arms crossed. And he got literally no reaction. And meanwhile, all the wrestlers at ringside, all the guys from the mafia and aces and eights, they had to stand around and pretend to be shocked. Ken Anderson's attempt to sell the shock of the moment is still a meme to this day. He looked like he just remembered he left the fucking stove on in his house. But the orders to bring in Ortiz, it did not come from Impact. This was something that came from the executives at Spike TV. Because this was done as a way to promote an upcoming Bellator fight between Ortiz and Quentin Rampage Jackson, who was also in the ring that night. He had been doing some stuff with Impact. They were going to be having a fight on pay-per-view. It was a fight that never took place because Ortiz got injured days before the fight. But if you look at this whole thing, Ortiz ended up turning on the main event mafia to join Aces and Eights. And then all of a sudden, he and Quentin were pulled from TNA programming by Bellator. Bellator wanted him off TV, which rendered this whole August 1 warning thing entirely pointless. But to their credit, Impact every August 1st on their Twitter, they do wish everybody a happy August 1 warning anniversary, and they link to the clip. So they are openly aware of the fact that it sucked, but they have embraced it. They don't shy away from it. They have some fun with it. So that's pretty cool. 6 years ago this week on the July 27th, 2015 episode of Raw from Oklahoma City, John Cena beat Seth Rollins to retain his United States Championship. Rollins' WWE title was not on the line in the match. This is the match where Rollins kneed Cena in the face and broke his nose. He didn't just break his nose, he moved it about 3 inches over on the side of his face. It looked awful. And Cena underwent surgery a few days later for a nasal fracture, but ended up being pulled from several live events. He returned the Friday before SummerSlam that year at a house show in Bridgeport in Connecticut. And 1 year ago this week, on July 31st, 2020, The Fiend attacked Alexa Bliss. There was a match on this show in the main event in the Empty Performance Center in Orlando on SmackDown between Bayley and Nikki Cross. And Bayley beat Nikki. Nikki was very frustrated when the match was over. And Alexa, who she was friends with on TV at that time, was trying to console her. And Nikki shoved Alexa down on her ass. And she walked out. All of a sudden, the lights go out. And now we see when the red light comes on, Alexa is sitting in the ring, terrified. And standing behind her is The Fiend, who circles around her and kneels down beside her and puts his glove up in the air, the hurt glove, brings it to her mouth, and he applies the mandible claw. We got man-on-woman violence here at the end of this show. Bray Wyatt playing head games in storyline with Braun Strowman, who had, you know, an affection for Alexa, and I think they were partners in that mixed match challenge thing, so he was trying to fuck with Braun Strowman, basically, in their feud, by going after Alexa Bliss. And here we are, 1 year later, Alexa Bliss is the new Fiend. And 1 year later, on this very day, Bray Wyatt was served his walking papers by WWE. And that is this week in wrestling history. You can always email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I want to hear from you if you've got questions, if you've got suggestions, if you've got whatever, if you've got special lottery numbers, whatever it might be, you can email me there. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my handle. And you can become a Sound Off channel member on YouTube. Any video, you'll see a join button underneath the videos there. You can click join. It'll give you all the information. You got the Sound Off Superstars tier. You got the Sound Off Legends tier, which gives you access to all the retro audio that's going up each and every month. There'll be more of that coming, especially those old SE Scoops Live episodes, which you can't find anywhere else. So you can head over there. And, you know, when these history clips go up on YouTube, one new feature that has just been enabled on the channel, we have Super Chats, right, during the live streams. Well, now we have Super Thanks. You don't have to be live. Any clip, any recorded clip that you upload, you'll see a little, like a some text or a button, whatever you want to call it, called thanks under the video. It's almost like a tip jar. Entirely voluntary, but if you enjoy these history segments, you'll find the thanks button underneath those videos when they go up on YouTube. And if you want to show your support, that's another way you can do so. So I just wanted to make everybody aware of that. I am going to be back with you for episode 716. Next Sunday, as we roll on towards SummerSlam and all of the big AEW events coming up, I'm going to have you guys covered with everything here on the podcast and on the YouTube channel. I'll be live, of course, this Wednesday for my Dynamite review, and we'll be picking a winner to the Wrestle Rumble art contest, so you still have a few days to get in on that. If you want to try to win that Seinfeld meets pro wrestling piece of artwork. Busy week. I'm sure next week will be just as busy. Until then, be well. Stay safe. Have yourselves a great start to the month of August. Thank you again for everybody who picked up a copy of The Adventure of Hardy the Horse. I thank you for that. And I'll see you back here for more Sound Off next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The Salamonster Sounds Off.
What is the point of Tony Schiavone even coming down to the ring to do these interviews if every single time they pull the microphone out of his hand? There were a couple of AEW diehards who got very upset. Oh my god, you're criticizing. But these will be the first fucking people. If WWE did something like this, oh, they'd be online. Oh my god, WWE, look at this. What a shit product. God forbid you say something negative about AEW. Holy shit. The world is just falling down all around us. You people gotta cool your jets. Don't tell me what to tweet on my Twitter. You can go fuck yourself.
The Salamonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Salamonster on Twitter at Salamonster.
Salamonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.